Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Since ancient times, Egypt has expressed an irresistible spiritual magnetism on the hearts of millions of people. Experience 14 magic days in Egypt, exploring Cairo, the pyramids of Giza, and the temple of Dendera and Abydos with Maureen St. Germain. You cannot see it on your own as well as you can with this group. Click on the 14 magic days banner at X Squared Radio and join us in Egypt from October 6th through the 20th. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. The solar wind tonight is 450.2 kilometers per second, and the sun is again absolutely blank today. There is a coronal hole that is streaming radiation toward us, and it did cause some beautiful auroras a couple nights ago. And perhaps there will be one tonight, so go out after the program and have a look if you're in the northern part of the planet. After a slow Saturday at the 2007 Space Elevator Games in Farmington, Utah, Sunday is shaping up to be a much more exciting adventure for them. Three teams attempted to climb up a pretend space elevator cable using solar-powered vehicles. A real space elevator would use a cable around 100,000 kilometers long to reach far into space. For the purposes of the competition, however, a much smaller tether, 122 meters long, held by a crane, was used. NASA has promised $500,000 to the team whose vehicle can make the climb at a speed of 2 meters per second. If more than one team achieves this, the team that can carry the most weight up the climb wins. All three teams used mirrors on the ground to reflect sunlight onto the solar panels attached to the bottom of their vehicles. The first team from the University of British Columbia made it up about 75 meters, but their vehicle was moving slowly, much less than 1 meter per second, and they ran out of time without having reached the top. The second team, called the Technology Tycoons, made it all the way to the top, but were also much too slow to win the prize. The third team was by far the most exciting. After a long wait for clouds to clear, the Kansas City Space Pirates finally started their run. A block of solar panels fell off early in the climb, but the vehicle was still able to move quickly, at times topping 2 meters per second. The vehicle reached the top in 1 minute and 18 seconds for an average speed of about 1.6 meters per second. Too slow to win the prize. Still, it was the fastest run so far, and the team looked pretty happy. And then as the vehicles were descending, they started falling apart. Some of the pieces fell off and fell down. Good thing the team was wearing hard hats. Also, a new league that plans to race rocket-powered planes for spectators made the first test flights of the vehicle to be used in its races. The Rocket Racing League's president, Granger Whitelaw, who won two Indy 500 races as a team owner, made the announcement at Holloman Air Force Base near Alamogordo, New Mexico, which is hosting the Wirefly XPRIZE Cup this weekend. X-Core Aerospace built the vehicle as part of a partnership with the league. The vehicles are basically gliders with rocket engines, according to Jim Bridenstine, who will fly one of the vehicles when races begin. Sounds like my kind of race. The engines can be turned on and off repeatedly during the race, but cannot be throttled to adjust the thrust. Sounds like my kind of driving, all the way to the floor or no gas at all. The vehicles will fly at about 550 kilometers per hour. That's about 300 knots. Bridenstine told me at the International Symposium for Personal Spaceflight in Las Cruces, New Mexico on Thursday, I wondered if this would look anything like pod races in the Star Wars Episode I movie. Bridenstine said, that's actually the visual we're going for. It should be a lot like the pod races. Sounds like X Games is going to have its competition. Also, if you're out looking at the night sky tonight, you might notice exploding comet 17P Holmes. It's now larger than Jupiter. The diaphanous and curiously spherical cloud surrounding the comet's core is now large enough to swallow the king of planets. It's gotten so big, in fact, that many observers say they can see it without a telescope. What would make a comet explode in this fashion? Actually, a better question is, what would make a comet explode twice in this fashion? This is the second time Comet 17P Holmes has erupted. The first was in 1892, an outburst that led to the comet's discovery by British astronomer Edwin Holmes. The answer may be sinkholes. There is growing evidence that some comets and asteroids have a porous internal structure akin to, you guessed it, a hollow planet. Suppose one of the chambers of the honeycomb suddenly collapsed, exposing many square kilometers of fresh cometary ice to sunlight for the first time. A flurry of sublimation would ensue, with mega jets of dusty gas emerging from the sinkhole to create a cloud around the comet, much as we see now. Two sinkholes, one in 1982 and one in 2007. And we also want to let you know that the Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 3, is now at the publisher. It's called Unlocking the Secret. It will be off the presses fairly soon. We'll let you know. And, of course, you can be able to find it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble and, of course, at our website at x2-radio.com. We're pleased that you're with us tonight on the BBS Radio Network. And if you want to call in, we will be accepting live phone calls all night. Toll free in the U.S., 877-270-8714. That's 877-270-8714. Toll free anywhere in Canada, 888-228-4494. And anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530 413-4511. Well, my dear Earth Explorers, you are in for a special treat tonight. My guest holds more world records in more fields of engineering than we could possibly cover in one program. He holds the record for the highest mileage out of a gasoline-powered vehicle. Actually, he broke his own record twice, and all three records are still unbroken by anyone else. He is the three-time record holder of the most miles traveled by an electric car in a single charge, and he has made the cover of USA Today with his winning style. I mean, the entire front page of USA Today, above and below the fold. His inventions and engineering feats are enough to keep a dozen large corporations busy trying to get them into service around the globe. He has done the work that could establish energy independence for all of us. He has been on every major television network and still is the man to catch for new energy technology. We are so very privileged and pleased to have him on our program tonight. Please welcome with me Joseph LaStella. How are you, Joseph?
Very well, Brooks. Just got off a plane and picked up a phone and I'm ready to do a very exciting program tonight.
Well, this is going to be fun. You know, probably every listener we have out there has seen the film Who Killed the Electric Car? And you and I were talking about a month ago, and you told me there was a major part left out of that film. Let's talk about what was left out of that movie. First of all, how did you get started in the race to build a practical electric car?
Well, that goes back to 1992. If you recall, California had passed a mandate that by 1998 they would have at least 2% and then gradually increasing to 10% electric vehicles on the road. of course, that mandate failed later on, because the automobile companies fought a legal battle in all the courts. However, it stayed in place long enough to give a real boost to the electric car industry. Now, Brooks, in 1992, there were no real electric automobiles. There were golf carts. And we had to bridge that gap and do what the automobile had done for the American scene in 100 years. All right, we could not build a Model T. The American public, in fact, the world public, would not drive a car like that. It had to behave like a real car. It had to have the same acceleration, and people should just be able to get into it and drive it. And that was a monumental task. In 1994, the United States federal government, because there was all this talk about electric automobiles, sent out a request for proposal for electric automobiles. They wanted to find out exactly where the automobile was in its technology. That RFP was answered by as many as 100 U.S. companies. Then the federal government surprised everyone by saying, you've got 6 months to give us that car so we could test it under federal guidelines. Well, you know, that's where the buck stops. 6 months later, out of all those corporations, only four were able to come up with any car at all.
Wow.
There was a Green Star product at that time was called Bat International. There was a U.S. electric car, Solectria, and Chrysler. So out of all the United States, there was only four companies. They gave to the federal government seven electric cars, and out of the seven cars that they tested, three of them were from Green Star products.
Wow.
So virtually three-sevenths of all the cars in the U.S. came from our company. And they tested them for 30 days, and the final analysis was given by the ex-CEO from General Motors at the French Pavilion in Washington, and they showed all the cars and their performance. And quite frankly, we surprised a lot of them. I'm a licensed professional engineer, and they allowed me to be on the test site for the entire 30 days, Brooks.
And
that was a godsend, really, because I was wearing two hats. One, you know, as the president of my company, and the other one as a licensed professional engineer. And to say the least, the protocol for testing these cars was not established. We established it. the precedents and the test protocols at during those 30 days. And believe me, there's a lot of arguments. You know, we even did, for example, during the testing program, we tested them for everything: slalom, brake testing, you just name it. The most distance on one single charge. But you know, I overheard some people saying and laughing about the electric car from the federal government, and I could see where they could understand that. They thought we had golf carts there, and they said, "Well, wait till we see how these cars crash test." Well, we already crash test our car, and we came out with flying colors. All right, but then they were saying, "Well, these cars are a little bit overweight. They think that maybe we're amateur engineers or something, that we wouldn't compensate for the extra weight of the batteries." So our truck, all right, which weighs a little over 3,600 pounds on a braking test from 60 miles an hour, all right, stopped, if I recall, it was somewhere below 160 feet. I think it was 155 feet from 60 miles an hour. And that is better than most cars can do today on the road. In fact, it would take almost a race car to stop in that short a distance. And when they start seeing things like that come out, they stop laughing after a while. You know what I'm saying? Well, very well, the electric car was born, all right, and we built a lot of vehicles. We built Ford Ranger trucks and, Geo Metros and many of them, and all sorts of cars. In fact, as far as I know, they're all on the road right now till today.
The electric cars that you built are still on the road.
Oh, yeah, because, electric motors don't wear out. Some of the electric motors that Edison built at the turn of the century are still running, all right? The rest of it is all solid state, all right? So, in fact, what we had designed into our automobiles was a box about a foot and a half wide, 18 inches by 12 inches by 6 inches, and all the components were in that, except the electric motor and the battery. So if anything went wrong with the car, we had military quick disconnects on them. There was nothing to do on the car. You went there and you pulled that box out and you put another box in and you went back on the road again. By the way, in all the time that we ran, we never had to replace not one of those modular control units.
Well, how much exposure did you get with your electric designs? Was your engineering...
There was a tremendous amount of exposure, I guess it's part of history now, so I guess, I could say it on the air, but, we had a deal with Ford Motor Company, not at the top level, I would say at the dealer level. And we used to buy all these new Ford trucks, and we would take the motors out of it, and the gas tanks and the radiators and everything that we didn't need. And the dealers would buy them back because they're brand new, they're right out of their own showroom, right? So, literally, we had, what they call, quote, gliders, and we made them ourselves. And within 2 days, through our assembly facility, we would take all these components out, throw the electrical components back, and you had an electric automobile, And we went out of our way not to touch any of the original electrical parts. From the battery down, we didn't touch anything. And for a while, for over a year, all right, guess what? The regular dealers honored the warranty on the truck, believe it or not, all right? As long as we didn't touch any of this, the braking system and all of that, they honored it. And then, upper people, upper echelons at Ford Motor Company found out about it, and they gave us a cease and desist, and things got really out of hand, all right? Bloomberg, called us up from New York and asked us if we had any comments, about the cease and desist. To make a long story short, I don't want to put Ford Motor Company's nose out of kilter on this program, all right? But it all worked out, all right? And the final analysis was that they said that they would work out things with us. The cease and desist went away, and we went on making, Ford electric trucks. Of course, the mandate died, and even so, we had these great electric automobiles. When the mandate died, the electric car died with it. There are still a lot of people who wanted electric automobiles. But since you brought up the subject, I didn't mean to get off on the subject right away. The electric car will make a serious comeback in the next 2 years. Now, people would say, why? Well, first of all, electric car today is a very modern automobile, okay?
Sure.
The vehicles we built, all right, that's all you had to do was plug them in a wall socket at night, you know, drive to work, drive back, do whatever you wanted, and you drove it just like a regular car. But the question is, why would it come back? The reason...
Well, you know, a lot of the electric cars that are out there on the road today, and there are quite a few that drive around the Los Angeles area, they don't go very far on a charge. How far did your car go on a charge?
The statistics, actually, we did a lot of work here, and a lot of investigative work, and the average car in the U.S. today, 80% of them drive less than 30 miles. Perfect for an electric automobile, all right, especially for short commutes back and forth. In fact, every car that we sold to anybody in that era, all right, when they told their corporation they had an electric car, they wanted to put it out front someplace, so they gave them a free charging station right in the front of the building, so when everybody walked in, they could see that they had, you know, this electric car, and they were being part of the green movement. Now, why is electric car going to come back? We'll get into this later on about peak oil and global warming and on engineering terms, Brooke. I give out numbers. What the thing that I do with our public corporation, Wall Street really hates it because I don't wave a flag and say buy my stock. All right, I give very long press releases with specific data so that engineers and people that know the business can understand where we are and why we're doing it and how advanced we are. Totally different. You read any one of my press releases and you'll see the details. I get calls from all over the world. One fellow from France called me up 5 times telling me, he's still learning from some of the information I gave him, you know, concerning, you know, global warming and peak oil, of course. But, why electric automobiles? Because the electricity in the United States, now, I'm sure that almost no congressman knows this, all right? The electricity produced in the U.S. comes 96% from non-oil production units. Only 4% is produced by foreign oil. If we ran off oil tomorrow, the electricity in your house would stay on. It comes from mostly coal, natural gas, hydro, some wind, some solar, but it's all here in the U.S. So when everybody eventually has no fuel to put in their vehicles, guess what? If you've got an electric car, you could put in that electric socket, and you'll be the only one riding around. It's going to make a real comeback.
Well, that makes an electric car very practical. You set a world record with the longest drive on a single electric charge, and the first time you did it was a contest in Utah, right?
Well, yeah, we challenged the whole world to this event. At that time, the longest distance ever driven with an electric car, what really was a car with just loaded down with batteries, was a little over 200 miles, and we put up a big grand prize, $25,000, and we drove from Salt Lake City to Wendover, Nevada, which is on a state line, and back again. And to make a long story short, we set the first record at 406 miles. The second record down Highway 5 in California from San Francisco to Anaheim at 450 miles. Later on, we did a cold weather run in Utah with air zinc batteries, okay, with a van in 32-degree weather. We set over 400 miles on that. And then the granddaddy was in Alameda, California, at the base up there. They allowed us to use the base to run the vehicle, and we did over 1,034 miles on a single charge. And then we went to Pikes Peak, and in 1994, we broke the 1993 world's record with a production automobile of Pikes Peak. That's very important to realize that, I drove that car that year, and we broke the 1990, no, Brooks, I'm just going to go back to let you understand how important this was, okay? 10 years before that, a sand rail loaded with batteries was the first car I'd ever make it up Pikes Peak, period. All right? Any electric car. And it was like some long distance. I mean, it was like 40 minutes or something like that. And then 10 years went by. And then the year before that I ran, another Sandrail loaded with batteries broke that record by about 10 minutes. So it was 27, from 37 to 27 minutes approximately. And then the next year I drive a production car off my assembly line. All right? Now, the other cars have, you know, have broken my record, obviously, but not with a production car. They had very expensive automobiles that never went on a production line, and the battery packs were lithium-ion or some of those very expensive battery packs, over $100,000 a piece. I did it with the car off my assembly line, and I broke that record by 3 minutes, all right, against a Sandrail that a year before that was hailed for breaking the record. 24 minutes, I made it up Pikes Peak. And as far as I'm concerned, until somebody else breaks out my record with a production car, I own that record. Because everything after us was never put in production, and they use the most expensive battery packs in the world. I use lead-acid batteries to climb Pikes Peak.
Wow. And your car, because of its design, did it corner well?
It not only cornered well, it cornered like a race car. In the final design in 1995, we had the batteries under the car, okay, under the floorboard. If you were going to design a race car, you know that they put the engine, mid-engine cars on race cars. The reason they do that is because it gives you almost a zero polar moment of inertia. In other words, you don't have like a barbell in your fist in your hands. If you took a barbell and swung it around in the fist of your hand with the weights on the outside, it would break your wrist right off. But if you took the same weight and put it in the palm of your hand and held it like a big ball and twisted it, there's no moment of inertia on it. So all this weight of the car was in the center of the car, but even race cars can't put it close to the ground, and we could because we put it under the floorboard. So this thing cornered, you know, like on rails.
Wow. Now, that means you could use the rest of the space in the car, your trunk and your back seat and all that. It wasn't taken up with batteries, was it? This was a regular production car.
Brooks, this is so funny. You know, I went to Europe those years, and I'm not going to mention the name of the companies, but I saw all the electric cars they had in Europe, and they were station wagons with a back seat loaded with batteries, all right? Our car, you know, they would open up the hood, and you see, you know, electronics and an electric motor. And you go up the back, and you open the back trunk up, and there's no batteries in the trunk. And then you look in the back seat, and we had full five passengers. Where's the? I couldn't even find the batteries on our car because they were under the car, you know. So it was really a great automobile. And you know, I don't have a 1995 version. I sold all of them, but I just so happened to have one 1994 version left, which was a little different. But I kept that one because Vincent Granatelli drove that car. I gave it to him for 2 weeks to drive. Because Vincent, you know, people know he's very meticulous. And he drove the car for 2 weeks, and he says, Joe, it's a great car. I had it up to 100 miles an hour. You heard that? 100 miles an hour?
Wow.
And he says, there's only one problem with it. He says, you know, he says, Joe, he says, it's so quiet. It really is. Brooks, it's absolutely quiet. You can't, there's no noise at all. He said, you know, I hear those pebbles hit the bottom on the underneath of the car, and they're bothering me because there's more than noise. That's a true story, Bill. And that car, by the way, Brooks, I still have that car, and someday I wish you would drive it, all right? I guarantee you, you will not put your foot all the way down the floor because you'll peel 40 feet of rubber.
Wow. Now, was your electric car safe? I mean, did it pass any crash tests?
Yeah, we took it to New York in a regular crash test sequence, all right, and we crashed it according to the crash test criteria in those years, all right, and we passed all the crash test data. And I bet you if I look for it, I still could find the crash test, not only the results, but probably the video. In fact, if you remember, during those early years when streaming video was just brand new, all right,
mm-hmm.
They used that crash test series, all right, as one of the first, you know, videos on the first streaming video.
Wow. So you think that electric car technology, your electric car technology, would sell in today's marketplace?
Well, not maybe not in the United States, You know, I don't know. But, you know, for example, India is talking about, I guess you read about this a few days ago, they're talking about building a $3,000 automobile in India, and now I think it was Nissan said they want to get involved in that. Well, India can build that. I was in the Indian plants in 1993 and 1994. You know, they're very good at what they do, but they're very inexpensive. You know, with labor, you're paying $1.50 a day. At that time, they were using a Briggs & Stratton engine, and the cars at that time were about $1,800 a piece. So if you had to go someplace, in fact, the reason I went there, because I was trying to convince them to take that cheap car, $1,800, pull this Briggs & Stratton engine off, right, beef it up a little bit. Not, you know, their A-frames were not quite as strong as they should be, but that's pennies on a dollar to do that. And then they could have made it into an electric car for India, you know. The nice thing about electric automobiles, they last forever, and when the new battery packs, whatever they are, come down the road, you just put new batteries in them. There's nothing else to do. It's electrons, you know. So you don't throw your car away like you would do a regular car. The only thing you do is take your battery pack out and put a new battery pack in. That's more advanced, you know.
What engineering challenges need to be overcome to make an electric car that Americans would buy today?
Well, no, I think it's there. I don't think until people have a need like no more fuel, will they get interested in the electric automobile. The mentality is just not there. We've been down that road. There's no mandates, and nobody really cares. You know, so of course you always have the limitation of range. All right, so it's got to be a commuter type car, something you take to town, things like that. You know, I mean, you give up a little bit, but you get a lot in return. All right, the electric car under any circumstances gets the energy equivalent of well over 100 miles to the gallon. You go out and buy a gallon of gasoline, and you put the equivalent dollars of electricity in that car, and you go 100 miles.
Well, now that sounds like something attractive, because I was watching the news Friday, which is unlike me. I don't watch the news very often. But they said that oil had reached $91 a barrel. It's not going to take long before that shows up at the pump. We might have plenty of oil, but you might be spending $400, $500, $600 a month to drive. It sounds to me like the economics are getting right for an electric car.
Yeah, they are. But Brooks, I know we started off on an electric car. I guess, you know, I didn't want to start off this way, but it's a pretty interesting story. But we really need to talk about global warming, and we need to talk about peak oil, because that's our specialty. We have predicted everything that's happening today years ago. And when I predict something, it's not like, you know, in a gray area or mirrors, all right? I put it in press releases. In fact, I called up my webmaster and told him to take two editorials I wrote several years ago, one on global warming and the other one is on peak oil, and they're on the front of my website now. I think everybody listening to this program had better read them and remember when they were written. They were written long before Al Gore did his special program documentary, all right, and long before people were predicting, you know, $80, $90 or $100 oil. Now,
Just so our listening audience knows where to go, what is your website?
Yeah, it's GreenStarUSA.com.
GreenStarUSA.com. That's where you can go to read the articles. Well, the reason I started out with the electric cars, because with Joe LaStella, that's the short story. What you are about to hear, if you just tuned in, this is X Squared Radio. We're on for 3 full hours. Our guest tonight is Joseph LaStella, world record holder in numerous engineering technologies. And we want you to call in live so you can talk to Joseph and ask him questions. Toll-free U.S. is 877-270-8714. Toll-free in Canada, 888-228-4494. And anywhere else on the planet, if you've got a free long distance, you can call in on this number, 530-413-4100. 4511. Also, if you've got AOL Instant Messenger, look me up. My sign-on is Vision Officer. So you can find me at Vision Officer on AOL Instant Messenger, and you can flash your question to me, and we'll put it on the air. I wanted to make the transition now from the electric car. I know many of you have seen the movie Who Killed the Electric Car. It's alive and well. It's just that perhaps public demand for the electric car isn't really there, as the press would lead you to believe. Well, if you've thought you've heard amazing things so far, we haven't even scratched the surface, because we're about to pass into more conventional technology that would solve the problems of global warming. I don't think there's any doubt that the planet's warming. Joseph was one of the first ones to publish meaningful engineering data, not opinionated data, that the Earth was warming and that we were headed for big trouble. But Joseph didn't sit idle. He immediately began into technology that would solve that problem. He doesn't sit around and complain. He does something about it. So what was your first step to solve the problem of an alternative fuel for automobiles?
Brooks, the listening audience, I need to talk to them for a moment. I think they really, if they can, listen to this entire program. It will change the way they look at things, and I'll give them all the engineering data that they can follow very carefully that will protect them from what's going to happen very, very soon. We predicted everything that's happened up to date, and tonight, you know, we're going to predict, we're going to give you the data, and you decide what's going to happen. For example, I'm going to tell you a little story, Brooks. A year and a half ago, I was at a Christmas party, a very elegant Christmas party. There was two vice presidents from one of the nation's largest retail outfits, and I was introduced to them. And I was introduced as, you know, introduced as the CEO of a company that was in the alternate fuel business. And, you know, they said, well, yeah, okay, they were nice, but they sort of brushed me off, which really got me a little bit angry. So I said, can I have just 30 seconds of your time, please? I said, you know, Brooks, I always carry this card in my pocket. I pull this card out, and I says, I'd like to ask you a question. As on this card, I have the names of 10 countries in the order of which they have oil reserves. Where do you think the United States is?
Now, as far as oil reserves?
That's a
great question.
Well, you know, one guy said number 3, the other guy said number 4, and that's normally what people would say. They think we're right up there.
We have a caller.
So now, let's shock your audience, all right? The United States has only 2% of the known world oil reserves.
2%.
Yet, every single day, we burn 25% of all the oil produced each day. Got that? 2%
wow.
Reserves, 25% we burn. I don't think you want to take that to Las Vegas and place a bet that we're energy independent and we're ever going to be.
Wow.
All right.
Hey, Joseph, I think we have a caller on line one. Caller, can you give your first name and where you're calling from?
Yes, my name is Mahmoud. I'm calling from Lake, and I happen to know Joe personally, and I testify to everything Joe said about the electric car. However, what I wanted to say regarding the global warming, which is a topic he hasn't started discussing, in our local paper 2 days ago, there was an article about the UN complaining about farmers that grow in crops to produce biofuel from or biodiesel, and they're complaining that's going to disrupt the economical scale and increase the commodity prices. So to grow canola or soybean, whatever other crop, is going to disrupt this whole equation and it's self-defeating. So
that is
interesting. I think Joe has the solution, you know, to remedy that and take care of the problem.
That's certainly something that has made the news, Joseph. These alternative fuels, like growing corn to solve the gasoline problems, has driven the price of corn up. What's going on, Joe?
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, corn takes food off our tables, and there's a world resistance right now in protest. First, it started in Mexico. The tortillas are made from corn, so their base product has doubled in price in the past year. We've gotten protests from India, and also even Germany is having riots because their beer has gone up. Now, Betty brought that up a little too soon, but I'll address it right now. AP, all right, and Reuters yesterday, and I want to say these words very clearly, all right, that biofuels is a crime against humanity because of this. And they're asking, all right, the UN to put a moratorium on making fuel from biofuels. Now, if you're going to use food to do that, and use agricultural land and fresh water to do that, I absolutely agree. All right, we are the soybeans, for example, have gone from $5.80 to over $10, breaking all kinds of records.
Wow!
And it's ricocheted through the entire industry. Corn has gone out of sight, like I just mentioned, and it's affected wheat prices. We used to pay $3-4, a bushel for wheat. It pushed up to $9. So it's affecting everything across the entire world, and we're starving people to put fuel in our tanks. Is there any out to this? Now, the answer is absolutely yes. That was our whole research effort for the last 5, 6, or even 7 years. Green Star Products, with its consortium of companies, is dedicated to solving that problem. All right? So now, with all of that, what is one of the solutions? Let's tack them one at a time.
Okay,
right?
Let's go. One at a time. Here
one
we
at
go.
A time. Biodiesel. You should not use soybeans. You can use maybe canola oil because, you know, that people don't eat the protein from the canola oil or anything like that. However, the answer is algae. Now, people ask me this question all the time. Algae is new. Where did this come from? Algae is not new. Algae is 3 billion years old. 3 billion years ago, this was an uninhabited planet, all right? But algae has the wherewithal to take CO2 out of the atmosphere, take the sea out of it, make oil and other things out of it, carbohydrates, proteins, and release oxygen to the atmosphere. So over millions of years and hundreds of millions of years, algae took the CO2 out of the atmosphere and put the oxygen that we have today back. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be here. The second piece of that is that oxygen usually in the atmosphere is O2. But the sun comes down, and once in a while it breaks one of these O2s apart, and O doesn't like to be alone. It likes to get married very quickly. So it looks for something else and attaches to another O2, which makes it O3, and that makes our ozone layer, which protects the Earth from the ultraviolet rays of the sun so that we don't get killed with the ultraviolet rays. Without algae, no ozone layer, no oxygen, no life, period. So we are now using a technology that's 3 billion years old. And guess what, algae eats? I got 5 points here. I'm going to state them very slowly because they're so important. They are the basis of what the world is going to build its new fuel supply on. Algae, number one. Algae produces 100 times more oil per acre than traditional oilseed crops like soy and oil. That's absolutely true. Soy and corn produce roughly anywhere between 50 to 100 gallons of oil per acre. Today's algae, not the future algae, what we have ready to go today produces 4,000 gallons of oil per acre, almost 100 times more.
Wow.
Number two, what does algae need? All right, algae needs, guess what, CO2, a major global warming gas, and produces what we really need is oxygen. Us as human beings, we breathe in oxygen, give out CO2. The plant takes CO2 in, and algae takes CO2, gives us our oxygen back. It's like, you know, we interface with them. CO2, by the way, comes out of your car. So if you can actually take the exhaust out of your car or out of a smokestack from an electric utility and feed it to the algae, and it will eat it. So not only do we make oil from algae and attack the peak oil problem, but we also are solving the global warming problem.
Are there other industries that pump a lot of CO2 out that could be linked up to an algae farm?
Everything. Ethanol plants, any boiler, it just goes across the board. What's going on in the U.S. today is that electric utilities are barred from building any more coal-fired plants unless they can find out how to get rid of the CO2. And that's, by the way, that's also true with what they call like the cement plants. They put out a lot of CO2, so they're getting really, you know, pounced on by the federal government, local authorities, and they must find a way to get rid of the CO2. And some of the ways that you want to get rid of it are just bizarre, and they'll never work anyhow. But let's keep going on this algae. Number three, algae only requires sunshine and, get this, non-drinkable water. So we're not taking fresh water, which happens to be a kind of a short supply since global warming is, you know, the depleting our atmosphere of a lot of water, and all the glaciers are getting reduced. So this non-drinkable water, then what do we use? We can use salt water from the sea, which is true. That's what we use. All right? Green Star and their algae systems actually use salt water from the sea, or we can even use brackish water.
Wow.
The federal government has estimated, I'm going to read some pieces from the federal government report, but in New Mexico, in the desert there, it's worthless because below the desert there's an ocean of salt water. A perfect place. We need sunshine, and we need salt water and CO2, and that's it. And we make all the oil in the world, and guess what the byproduct is? The byproduct is high-protein food. We make more food. Number four, algae obviously does not compete with food crops for either agricultural land or fresh water. Kind of important. Number five, and you're going to love this one. Algae can reproduce itself every 4 to 8 hours. It takes Mother Nature millions of years to produce crude oil in the ground. That's true. You have to mine, or harvest algae in a pond almost every 4 days. Not once a year, not once a month, every 4 days, because it grows so quickly. The numbers are, if you take just one algae cell, will grow into 1,000,000 in 15 days. It will grow into a trillion in the next 15 days.
Now, does that take a special strain of algae? Is this unique to Green Star products, or can you just go pick up any old algae and do that?
There are almost any algae will produce very quickly during. And by the way, we built our technology on a pile of research that was done by the federal government that lasted almost 18 years. And we don't know how much they spent, probably $100 million, and comprised of at least 12 universities, and ended in 1995. All right? The aquatic program by the federal government took 3,000 strains across the United States, from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to Canada, and they tested these strains for reproducibility, environmental resistance, the amount of oil they contained, and they found that 300 of them would, you know, suffice in some respects to producing high, what they call lipid content. All right. So that body of evidence was absolutely wonderful, and that was our stepping stone. We started where they stopped. Now, why did they stop in 1995? Because I'm not going to mention them, all right, because I don't want to get in trouble. But one private agency and one government agency in 1995 convinced the administration that the price of crude oil would not go above $20 a barrel until 2020. You heard what I said? Obviously, they're wrong.
Yeah, they missed the mark a little bit.
They missed
bit,
the mark
I think.
Just by a little bit. All right, and they curtailed the only program that could have made us energy independent. Now, you know, I want to read some of the quotes by the INEL. All right, which is, you know, the last word in research government organization. All right. I'm going to close it, all right? Microalgae are remarkable and efficient biological factories capable of taking waste form of carbon, CO2, and converting it into high-density lipid form of energy, natural oil. I didn't say that. They said it, all right? The second thing they said, algae biodiesel is one of the only avenues available for high-volume reuse of CO2 generated by power plants. It is a technology that marries the potential need for carbon disposal in the utility industry with the needs for clean-burning alternatives to petroleum in the transportation sector. I mean, do I have to say any more than that? You know, this is what their conclusions from an 18-year study. And by the way, you know, there are other things that they're saying that fall right into what we talk about global warming today. All right, I just need to read one more of their conclusions.
Okay,
this one is going to knock you off your socks. Human beings are carrying out a large-scale geophysical experiment of a kind that never could have happened in the past or will be produced in the future. Within a few centuries, we are returning to the atmosphere and the oceans the concentrated organic carbon stored in sedimentary rocks over hundreds of millions of years. I mean, that's the end. Why do people in Congress feel that global warming is not happening? Their own people are telling them it's happening, you know? So, you know, with that, of course, you know, we wrote the reports, we wrote all the editorials, and we went on to algae research. And quite frankly, I think we're ahead of everyone in the business, all right? We already have our algae strains, all right? We've married up with several companies that are now part of our consortium, and we are the front runners in the algae business, regardless of what anybody's and any other fools say in the marketplace.
Well, it's kind of funny, you know. I did a little investigation of my own. I called around different algae companies who say that they're using algae for biofuels, and I said, "Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you send me a pound of your algae?" And they didn't have any. Now that's really surprising to me. If you've got an algae fuel company, aren't you making like thousands of pounds of this stuff every hour? You know, does Green Star have algae to ship?
Well, you know, I could show you a pickup load of it from a. We have a one tenth of an acre, 40,000 liter demonstration pond in Montana. It's on our website. Okay, now that's a tenth of an acre only. Okay, but it's 40,000 liters, and as demonstration ponds go, it's probably one of the largest in the world. Universities, if you look at their data, is usually derived from a pond about the size of two bathtubs.
Oh, two bathtubs.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness.
I'm serious. You know, I don't know how they figure, you know, they could upscale from that with any reasonable data. But ours is full scale, you know. And in a two-month period, all right, in fact, I'll put the picture on my website. I don't have it up there yet. You know, we have a picture of a pickup load of algae, you know, coming from a one-tenth of an acre over a two-month period. Obviously, we can make a lot of algae per acre if I can do that from one-tenth of an acre in a two-month period. You know, and our associate company, Biotech Research, all right, fine company, all right, has extremely excellent facilities at the University of Ensenada in Mexico, all right, and they're working desperately not on creating an algae that we need. We already have an algae that can produce 4,000 gallons per acre. But we have all kinds of algae. We have algae that produces high lipid contents. We have algae that reproduces very quickly. And we also have algae that's resistant to environmental changes. That's very important.
Yeah.
All right? So that you could do things with the algae, change temperatures, change salinities, change all kinds of things, and the algae will continue to grow. I wrote, if you go to our website and you start back somewhere in April, there are four or five press releases that are great details of all the successes we've had with our demonstration ponds. And based on that, all right, and which is also on our website, a two-minute video, all right, that was shown on Continental Airlines June and July of this year on every flight that was over 3 hours. 6 million people watched that two-minute video, all right. We have been contacted by 20, not companies, countries throughout the world to do algae biodiesel. And by the way, we haven't mentioned it. We're the leaders in the biodiesel industry too, all right. We make biodiesel and we from all kinds of products. So we're one of the few companies that brings together two technologies, all right? Biodiesel technology that can take anything. For example, we've turned biodiesel from feedstocks such as corn oil, soy oil, canola oil, waste vegetable oil, beef tallow, all right, from the beef packing plants, and hydrogenated oils, all right? We bathe hundreds of thousands of gallons out of those products and sold it to the industry, by the way, so through our proprietary reactors, which is also on our website. So we're one of the few companies that marries biodiesel technology and the feedstock that goes with it. And we predicted a long time ago that this, dilemma that's happening today about the feedstock crisis, we knew it was coming.
In the government didn't know it was coming because they've subsidized all these biofuel factories out there, and some of them are $50, $60, $80 million factories. They're closing down because they can't get feedstock.
You're absolutely right. In the last couple of months, I was offered to buy. Five biodiesel plants that are closed down, all right, at maybe 20 cents on a dollar because they have no feedstock. Over the past 2 years, at least 50 different people, I would say companies, contacted us to build biodiesel plants for them. Now, we've turned them down for a variety of reasons, all right? The first reason is that we don't sell iron. We don't sell our biodiesel plants.
Right, you're not just selling equipment to people. Yeah. You're a joint venture company.
That's right. We do joint ventures. So half of them got knocked out because they didn't want to do joint ventures. But the other half we refused because they had no feedstock and they wouldn't listen to the fact that there was a feedstock crunch coming down the line. You know, Ford, when he started to make his automobiles, realized that he had to control every piece that went into the automobile, like his tires. So he went to, you know, Brazil and South America and got his own rubber plantations, all right? Without the rubber, you can't put the car on the road. And without feedstock, you can't run your biodiesel plants. And they built them anyhow, and now there's no feedstock for them. So, and now there's also world protests about taking food off the table to make, you know, biofuels.
Yeah, that's what our first caller was mentioning from Kuwait, that he loved the technology, but he could see that it was hurting world food prices. Well, listen, we're going to take about a four-minute break. You can get yourself a glass of water, and we'll take care of some commercials here, and then we'll be back with more of Joe LaStella, world record holder, engineer extraordinaire. We'll be back in about 4 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years.
The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. We want to make sure you know how to get a hold of us tonight, because we have got a guest on tonight that is destined to change the world as we know it. You can call in toll-free anywhere in the United States, 877-270-8714. Anywhere in Canada, toll-free, 888-228-4494. And anywhere on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-4511. We also want to let you know that you can reach us through AOL Instant Messenger by doing a search for Vision Officer. You'll be able to get to us here and flash those questions to us, and we'll pose them to Mr. LaStella. My guest is Joseph LaStella. His website, greenstarusa.com. Besides being a world-leading engineer, and I'd say rather flamboyant at that, because he set several world records with his technologies, he likes to get out there in the public eye, and that's what he's doing with his company, Green Star Products. The thing that's hurting the biodiesel industry, or biofuel industry, that we've heard about in our last hour, was the availability of feedstock. That is the raw oil, whether it's vegetable oil or canola oil or soy oil, that goes into the reaction. Evidently, there are a lot of biofuel plants out there sitting nice and pretty with no feedstock, and they're going out of business right and left. And they've had their effect already because they're driving the cost of tortillas up in Mexico. But it seems like Green Star Products is on the leading edge of a new technology that's about to solve all that. So let's talk a little bit about that some more, Joseph. Let's talk about this flow of algae as feedstock for the biofuel industry. What makes it so tough to use algae?
As I mentioned earlier, this 18-year study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture produced an enormous amount of data. However, where they failed miserably was the fact that if you're going to make algae, and there are plenty of algae facilities around, and if you're going to make beta-carotene, which is you're going to be put in a bottle and sold for $10 a bottle or something like that, you could do and spend all the money you want because your end product, you're getting a large amount of money for it. However, if you're going to make oil for biodiesel at maybe $2 a gallon, and of course the byproduct of that is high protein food, all right? You need to do things right. Now, there are two types of production systems. One type is a closed system. It's in a tube, all right, and it's closed to the environment, and you control the environment completely. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, all right, except that everybody who's tried it has failed miserably.
Why is that?
I think that the Japanese know what they're doing, and they spent $250 million trying to make it work. Not make it work for everything else, make it work for fuel, and they failed. The general consensus of opinion across the United States is that closed bioreactors will not work cheaply enough, and people are still raising enormous amounts of money today on closed bioreactors. Now, I'll tell you where they do work. They work as inoculators for big, large-scale pond systems, all right? And believe me, I think we have a few in Mexico at our research facilities, you know, from our associate company, you know, Biotech Research.
Yeah.
They must have 30 or 40 of these on operation, but they're inoculators. You know, that's where we breed the original algae, and then we put it into large-scale commercial facilities. All right? So then the other type, which is very viable and very cheap, is open pond systems, which the U.S. government used and also failed.
Now, why did that fail?
Yeah, the reason they failed is they have no control of the environment at all for the algae. Day-night temperatures, all right, would vary anywhere between 35 and 40 degrees, shocking the algae. They couldn't control, don't forget there's salt water we're using, they couldn't control the salinity. You get a lot of evaporation in the summertime. You have to put salt water back in, and the salinity goes way up, destroys your pond. You can't control the pH of the pond. You can't control the light. Algae, believe it or not, does not like direct sunlight. It will kill it, all right? So 25 to 50% regular sunlight is what they really want. And the worst thing of all is open pond systems. You have all kinds of junk blowing in. Not only dirt and branches and things like that, but you have local algae coming in. And in certain areas, the local algae is stronger than your algae and will take over your pond. So you have what's called pond crashes. So where do we go from here? And that's where we started, all right? Our system is a hybrid system, incorporating the best qualities of both systems. It's proven. There are pictures on our website, you know, and we've been able to control the environment under very tight, I would say, environmental conditions. Not only that, the strain that we developed out of the university at Ensenada, all right, is very resistant to environmental changes.
You mentioned earlier that your test pond is in Montana.
Yep.
Now, they have pretty extreme temperatures in Montana. How is your pond doing?
It's doing really, really good, Brooks. I mean, we'll be able to control the temperatures. We have special techniques of doing that, all low cost. All the problems that they were faced when they did it in New Mexico, we have solved those mechanical problems, period. We've done it. So where they used to have temperature swings of 35 to 40 degrees a day, we've cut that all the way down, you know, to almost 14 degrees. To say the least, we have prolific growth in the ponds there. We feel that all of that has been absolutely solved. We're ready, you know, to go to commercial production. Now, one other thing about algae is that they've been around for 3 billion years, and they're very versatile. And I don't know if I can use this word on, you know, on radio, but if you screw around with them, all right, they can shift their cycles to compensate for things they don't like. So if you start, you know, changing the salinity of light or temperatures, right, they will do a variety of things. They will increase their oil content or make beta carotene or increase the toughness of their shell. They're very versatile, change their color. They'll go from green to red, you know?
Wow.
So people don't realize that these creatures know how to survive. And if you give them what they like, they will do wonders for you. Mark
now,
my words tonight,
you,
all right?
Once you get the pond set up, and you're treating your algae nicely, and it's growing along nicely, and you're harvesting it, you said, every 4 or 5, maybe 6 days.
Yep.
You don't have to put another plow to the ground, do you? You don't have to burn any diesel fuel. You don't have to burn lots of electricity to make this oil. The algae do it for you, right?
Well, you know, what the farmers, and believe me, we deal with a lot of farmers, they're saying, well, just isn't this going to take, you know, the place of what corn is doing for ethanol or soybeans are doing for biodiesel. And my answer to the farmer is, how much do you make per acre? What is that, $200, $300, $400, $500 per acre? 1 acre of algae will produce for you, all right, 4,000 gallons. And if you sold it at rock-bottom prices, that's $8,000 an acre. But that's not the only product you have. The byproduct is 80% of it is high-grade protein, over 30% protein, all right, that sells collectively for more dollars than the oil did. So you're getting $8,000 from the oil. You're getting $9,000 to $10,000 or more for the feed, all right, especially in today's market with all the feed going up, all right. So if you're going to bring in $18,000, $19,000, $20,000 an acre, I think the farmer could pay a little more attention to those acreages and put a few more bucks into them. You know what I'm saying?
And they realize that. Yeah, yeah. And you're not asking the farmer to take his prime corn growing or wheat growing land and turn it into algae ponds. You're using the property that's no good for any crops. All you need is what, 6-8 inches deep, plowed nice and wide and long, and you could make a biopond out of it.
Exactly right. And suppose, just for an argument of trying to compare of what is required, all right, as little as 3% of the agricultural land. Let's talk about agricultural land for a moment. If we took agricultural land, which we don't, but if we did, as little as 3% of the agricultural land in the United States can produce enough oil to take us off of foreign oil forever. Does that make sense to people? I mean, we're talking about an industry that's global. $3 trillion a year is spent on oil products throughout the world. The whole world is fighting over oil. It's becoming, you know, the center of almost every war around the world. And the answer is in this little microscopic piece here.
We
and you mean tell me we can't do enough research? We went to the moon. I think we could research this.
Wow. Well, it sounds like we have another caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from, and your first name, please?
This is Mark from Nashport, Ohio.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Brooks. Joseph, do you think that the global elite that own the oil companies and the military-industrial complex will oppose the adoption of algae as a viable solution to the world's oil problem?
Well, that's an excellent question. Actually, it's part of the rest of my program. You know, I mean, I hope I get to say it tonight.
You will. We'll
let
you say it.
We cannot, no matter what we do, we can never make up the gap. All the algae ponds in the world can't come online quick enough. You know, all the coal gasifications can't come online quick enough. That's not me. That's the experts of the world. And, you know, I could give you some data, which I will later on, or maybe on some other program, to show you that. Right now, we're not experiencing any resistance. In fact, a lot of the utility companies, cement companies, have their own problem. Right now, they cannot build another coal-fired plant in most states unless they can get rid of the CO2. So really, the shoe is on the other foot. If we can show them that we can take the CO2 and make anything out of it, all right?
Well, Joseph, officers from your company, including you, have been to Washington, right? You were instrumental in helping getting the legislation passed under which biodiesel operates today, were you not?
We don't like to brag about it, but that's absolutely true. In the short term, I just like to state that we were a critical piece in the existing legislation on biodiesel passing in Washington. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, you're humble, because I can tell you that the congressmen and senators in Washington know nothing about the biodiesel or biofuel industry, and they needed technological help to get this legislation passed. And it was Joe LaStella that went there and gave them that help. Now they understand the industry.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I didn't want to say that. You're absolutely right. It's a matter of education, all right? And you know, there's two things that go here simultaneously. It's global warming and peak oil. Now, I like to read just a little piece, all right, that brings us home, you know? And this was said by Mr. Anon, all right, who happens to be the retired U.N. Secretary General
of the U.N.,
of the United Nations. All right? I'm going to quote what he said. And I think it's pretty important for all our listeners. Climate change is not just an environmental issue, as too many people still believe. It is an all-encompassing threat. He went on to say, this is not science fiction. These are plausible scenarios based on clear and rigorous scientific modeling. A few die-hard skeptics continue to deny global warming that is taking place and still doubt it. They should be seen for what they are, out of step, out of arguments, and out of time. And that is the truth. We are out of time. And Brooks, I hope we have enough time in this program to give the listening audience all the data they need so they have something to grab onto. It's just not somebody saying that. We have all the data here, and I truly wish I can get a chance to say it all tonight.
Oh, Mark, do you think that there is an undercurrent in the government that would keep fuel technology like this from becoming to fruition in our country and helping us reach oil independence?
Well, I've heard that there's something that some call the Illuminati, which I guess are the 13 richest families in the world, and I think they probably own the majority of the oil industry and the military industrial complex around the world right now. And they may have a vested interest in keeping some of this information sequestered. I wondered why the mass media has not told the public about the use of algae as a solution to foreign oil. I wondered if you guys could comment on that at all.
Well, I think what Joseph has made clear is lots of people have tried it, but nobody's been successful until Green Star Products.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's great. Well, at least we've got a success now.
Well, that's why we're on the radio talking about it. So millions of people around the world, and we've had flash mail from Kuwait, from London, from Australia tonight, And we're posing those questions to Mr. LaStella, and he's answering them.
Great show, Brooks. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Joseph, continue on with Kofi Annan said we're out of time.
Listen, early in the program, we started, I told a story about I was at a Christmas party, and there was two executives from, you know, one of the big retail companies there, and I asked them the question about, you know, I had a list of 10 countries on a card, and where was the U.S. in relation to their oil reserves.
Yes, exactly.
And I think I said that they have 2% of the known world oil reserves, yet we burn 25% of all the oil in the entire world every day. Now, I like to pick up on that, okay?
Sure.
Because when I say that, people, knowledgeable people, would shock me or to say, well, you know, we have plenty of oil and we'll go and find it. Well, let's take a look at the actual data. Brooks, would you believe there are more oil wells drilled in the United States than the whole rest of the world combined?
Really?
That's right. More in the U.S. than the rest of the world, yet we still have only 2% of the known world oil reserves. So does that make any sense? You know, we're going to drill more holes? I don't think so. Then the next thing that comes up, you know, I say, you know, listen, do you realize that there had been no major oil fields discovered since 1970?
Really?
That's absolutely true. No major oil reserves discovered. All minor ones, all right? However, during that same period of time is when we had all this high-tech satellite technology available. So all the latest technology could not even find one more major oil reserve. I think that's a great impact to all of us. And by the way, one more would make no difference. Five more would make no difference, all right? Because we are using the oil up faster than you can imagine. For every barrel that we find today, we burn 9 more barrels. How do you figure that equation is going to work? We find one, we burn 9, all right? And to make things worse, the three existing major reserves, 1, 2, and 3, one's in Saudi Arabia, one's in Kuwait, and one, guess where it is, in Mexico. And it's been operating about over 2 million barrels a day for years. All three of those have exhibited enormous declines. And usually that's shown by the fact that they pump more water than oil each day. What really worries me, you don't have to worry about what's going on in the Arab world. Let's just look here on North America. Mexico, that major oil reserve, was pumping 2 million gallons a day, 2 million barrels a day, and has shown declines that we've never seen in any other oil reserve of that size. Last year, it went down to 1.6 million barrels per day, and they estimate that within 2 years, based on the existing decline, although nobody wants to admit it, but so many experts says they could drop down to 0.6 million barrels a day. That means we've lost 1.4 million barrels a day, and that's the equivalent of Iraq. We were fighting over oil right now, right on our own backyard.
That's a 75% decrease in oil production from our nearest neighbor to the south.
That's astonishing. When you look at it, you go, we're losing it right in our backyard. Venezuela is not exactly our good friend anymore, and they're a major oil reserve. In fact, you know, I think the president of Venezuela has had a few choice words that I can't even say on this phone, on this radio program about the United States. So they're not exactly friendly. I've also heard people say, well, we got the Alaskan pipeline. The Alaskan pipeline? At one time, it almost produced 2 million barrels a day. It's down to 800,000, all right? And even when it was producing 2 million barrels a day, we didn't even have the refinery on the West Coast. Some of that was going to Japan to get refined because we don't have refineries. I mean, this is like an unbelievable scenario on the American people. And even if it was producing 2 million barrels, which it's not, all right, that's only 10% of what we use every day. So there's no answers on any of the continents here. I've also heard, you know, people come to me all the time with these scenarios. Well, you know, Canadian, up in the Hudson Bay, they have all that tar sands up there. And this one I really love to answer. You know, by 2015, they're going to produce 3 million barrels a day. And the Canadians are in an uproar about it because to get the oil out of the tar sands takes a lot of energy. And what they're doing is they're burning their natural gas up there because they have no natural gas pipeline, so it's virtually for nothing. So they're burning all the natural gas to take the oil out of the tar sands or ship the oil, you know, other places in the world. And it's only 3 million barrels anyhow by 2015, not even a drop in a bucket. The Canadians themselves are saying, are we crazy? We're burning the natural gas, all right, which is a global warming, puts out global warming gases, and then when we make the oil, we burn the oil, we get a double whammy from it, all right? So it has a huge impact, you know, on global warming. Nothing makes any sense to anybody. I've also heard about coal reserves. Brooke, I'm sure you have too. You know, we have 250-year coal supply, all right, which is theoretically true. When was the last time you put a lump of coal in your gas tank to run your car? You know, I mean, you have to turn it to something else. You have to turn it to gas or something like that, or liquid.
Infrastructure. I can't think of any fuel. Where I went to college at Western Kentucky University, of course, a lot of the graduate programs were paid for by coal technology. Kentucky, as our listeners might know, has huge coal reserves and has a lot of power plants that operate off of coal. But even Kentuckians are getting tired of burning coal to make electricity. It pumps a lot of hot CO2 into the air, and these stacks are about 100 feet in diameter, and that's all they do 24 hours a day is belch CO2 into the atmosphere so that we can run our electric appliances and our homes and air conditioning and all of that, which if you live in the South, if you don't have air conditioning, you're not going to survive very long because it's not the heat. It's the humidity that gets you down there. So we have a situation where we're running out of energy. We're using more energy. We're making cars that get horrible gas mileage compared to the technology that we have available to us. And now it appears one company has come along and has a solution, something that will turn land no one wants, water no one will drink, into fuel that we can put into our gas tanks. And it, of course, does have two byproducts. One is oxygen, and the other is high-protein meal. Joseph, where's the downside with this?
Brooks, when I tell the story to governors and senators and congressmen, they almost can't believe it. You know, it's too good to be true, but it is true, all right? Mother Nature did that for us already. And slowly, like any other educational program, things are beginning to change, you know. I think that, in fact, especially in the Midwest, where they're getting a lot of pressure about their corn, you know, the corn producers, you're gonna laugh at this, all right, but I have to say it. The corn prices were so high that most of the farmers decided to break what was traditionally known as rotational crops, you know, raising. They're raising what is called now corn on corn on corn. Every year, corn in the same field to make the money. All right.
Well, what does that do for the land?
Destroys it. Absolutely destroys it. In fact, that's the new thing. Corn on corn on corn. All right. Which is terrible. All right, for the land. So they're destroying their land. Not only that, this year they ran into a real dilemma. You know, you harvest the corn once a year, all right?
Right.
The ethanol plants need a steady stream year-round. So now, guess what? All the silos, all the holding tank facilities are full to the gills with corn, and now farmers have all this corn. They got no place to put it. In Missouri, all right, if you go there now, you will see trucks lined up forever because they got to get rid of their corn. You know, some people would say, knowledgeable people, well, you know, if it rots, we can't eat it, but we can make, you know, ethanol out of it. No, you can't. If it rots, all right, it destroys the enzymes processing, and they won't buy it. So now The industry to be in today is building silos for corn as fast as you can, otherwise the corn's going to rot. So you see, there's ramifications for almost everything we do, and people don't even see down the road, people who have been in the farming business for four, five, six, seven, eight generations. They don't see it coming down the road.
Well, it doesn't take a great scientist to figure this out, that they are creating an even bigger disaster. And maybe if we use our intelligence and use our ability to communicate globally like we can here at X Squared Radio and like we do on the Internet, maybe we can make enough people aware of what is coming and irrefutably coming, destroying the land, filling up all the silos with corn that's just going to rot, inflating the price of corn so that third world countries can't even afford to eat, and making even bigger enemies out of people that should be our allies. And the solution is laying right here in a little green pond in Montana. Where do we go from here, Joe?
Well, you know, when I tell the story to other people, they still have a barrage of things that they want to get off their chest. You know, and anyone knows, you know, happens to be, listen, I love Arnold Schwarzenegger, but, you know, he talks about the hydrogen economy, and I think he converted his Hummer to run on hydrogen. Hydrogen is not an energy supply. Hydrogen doesn't come out of the ground. It has to be produced. It's like a pipeline. It's an energy carrier. Hydrogen, for the most part, is made from electricity. All right? I mean, all of it's made from electricity, but it depends on how you get your electricity. Most of it's made from power plants. So you get absolutely no benefit from a hydrogen-powered car. And people don't understand that. And by the way, you know, there are a few other problems. All right, a hydrogen-powered car, fuel cell car, is an electric car. You heard what I said? It's absolutely 100% an electric car where you've taken the battery out and you've put a fuel cell in that makes electricity. So now you have all the infrastructure changes associated with an electric car, and the fuel cell itself has a few problems. It runs on hydrogen. So now you have to have compressed hydrogen, and nobody knows how to compress it. All right, or you have to have some kind of a converter that takes methanol and converts it, you know, and breaks the hydrogen out of it and feeds it to your tank, all right, to your fuel cell, and that's, you know, like a little it's a refinery. It's a small refinery in your car to take methanol, convert it to hydrogen to run your car. The technology is not available. And will not be available for 20 years to do that, regardless of what anybody says. There's no infrastructure. Nobody knows how to operate on it, all right? And it's a monster. And people are talking about the hydrogen economy. The hydrogen economy is 30, 40 years away and will never bridge the gap that's happening right now. Now, if Arnold knew that, I don't know who's telling him what to do or what not to do. It's impossible. What you should take is the best people in the industry and just ask them, is this reality? And it's not. You're wasting your money on a hydrogen highway because it's not going to work. So that's the end of the story. There is no other story except for the fact that fuel cells themselves still have some real problems. You know, they don't work properly. There's all kinds of problems with them, and we'll solve them in the long run. And how, why do they sell the fuel cell? Because theoretically, it goes through a chemical conversion process, which is twice as efficient as burning something, all right? If you see a flame, you burnt it, you go through a different cycle. A chemical cycle is twice as expensive. But look at what happens. You got to burn coal or natural gas to make electricity. And then you got to take that electricity and make hydrogen out of it by splitting water. Then you got to take that hydrogen and you got to compress it with a lot of energy to put it in a tank and put it in a car and go through a fuel cell. There isn't one car, not one fuel cell car in the world, that gets better than 25 miles to the gallon on the hydrogen that's in it, and they don't account for all the other losses that are across the board. And one last fallacy that I've got to put to rest. They always say hydrogen cars and fuel cell cars emit only water. Baloney. They emit CO2 like every other vehicle, a little bit less, but they still emit it. Now, I want people in the audience to listen to how much we emit into the air. I'm not talking about people themselves. One tank full of gasoline in your car emits about 200, not milliliters, you know, not small quantities, not ppm. One tank full of gas, depending on the size of the car you've got, will emit over 200 pounds of CO2 into the atmosphere. A lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot per tank full. So if you think you're being, you know, an environmentalist, one tank full, 200 more pounds of the atmosphere.
So you're putting somewhere between 30 and 40 tons of CO2 into the air every year with your car.
Depending on how high, how far you drive. Absolutely. There's no question about it.
Now, someone has flashed a message in. What modifications do we have to make to a normal diesel automobile to run on biodiesel?
That's a great question. The answer is zero. There's no infrastructure. You can mix that B1, which means 1% biodiesel, all the way up to 100% biodiesel. All right? Where it's not true with ethanol, takes a special engine. You need a special ED85 engine to run 85% ethanol. And ethanol has a great, possession for grabbing water out of the atmosphere. In other words, it has an affinity to grab water out of the atmosphere.
Oh, and that's not a good thing for
that's
fuel.
That's not a good thing. You cannot put ethanol in a pipeline because if you transport it in a pipeline like a regular gasoline, it will pick up all kinds of moisture. And on the other side, you will not have, you will have all moisture in your pipe, in your ethanol. Whereas biodiesel is no problem. The only problem biodiesel really has, and that will come to an end pretty soon, is that in really cold weather, if you're running 100% biodiesel, you could have some filter problems. Not engine problems, filter problems. But I spoke with a fella from, actually, in St. Louis Airport, all right? He ran the emergency equipment in wintertime in St. Louis Airport. And he ran 20% B20 through the entire winter.
Really?
No problem at temperatures at 25 below zero. As long as you mix it with diesel, when it's warm, the B20 can run in almost any atmosphere, as long as you winterize it just like you would winterize regular diesel. Whatever you do to regular diesel, that's what you do. Mix it with B20, and he had no problems for 5 years in a row on emergency equipment for an airport, which is a real test.
So you're telling me that if diesel went through the pipeline like gasoline does now, we actually pipe gasoline across our nation to different distribution points.
Oh, yeah.
If we piped biodiesel from a biodiesel plant that was fed by algae in the middle of the desert, the biodiesel would be just fine when it arrived at its destination to be put in your tank.
It would, but I suggest that it's all gets blended beforehand, all right, so you don't have any gelling problems, you know. And it's only, I would say, a matter of, a short time before we end up with a biodiesel that's good for as much as 40 degrees below zero. I'm talking about algae biodiesel. We're on the cutting edge of that. There are already algae that make feedstock that, when it's converted to biodiesel, can be absolutely not, you know, it would be actually liquid and good for even aircraft at 40 below zero. That's probably 2 years away yet.
Well, 2 years sounds a lot better than 25 or 30 years for hydrogen technology. What's it going to take? What do we have to do from here? It sounds like we've got the perfect industry at the perfect time, and if $4, $5, $6 a gallon gasoline is not enough motivator, what do we need to do from here, Joe?
This is probably more of a educational process. People resist because they still have the belief that certain things are true. We just went through tar sands. We went through hydrogen. We went through a whole bunch of other things, you know, to show that there's a coal. There's no answers here. The sad part of it, and Brooke, you have to understand this, please, is that no matter what we do, we can never make up the gap that's happening with peak oil. All right? People say it's peak oil. By the way, by definition, that means when supply exceeds demand. Now, in 1954, they predicted that the U.S. would reach peak oil inside the U.S. by 1970. It happened like clockwork. Look at the graphs, all right? We were not energy independent since 1970, and they predicted in 1954. They have now predicted that we're in peak oil very close, either through it already or right on it, all right? But what saved us in 1970 is that we just started to buy cheap world oil. There's no other world oil to bail the world out of it. So we're there right now. And the wild card is China. Nobody predicted China coming on so quickly. And it's very dangerous, all right? China, just picture this. Every month, 1 million Chinese families enter, I would say, mid-income bracket of income. They want everything. They want cars, they want refrigerators, they want washing machines, they want everything, and they have the money to buy it because we're giving it to them.
But the Chinese yuan is a lot more powerful currency than the dollar is right now.
And that's quite correct. And it's also locked to the American dollar, by the way, which people don't like because the Chinese yuan is undervalued. If it ever went free to the marketplace, it would be worth a whole lot more than the American dollar. But they don't want that to happen, because if that happened, Chinese goods in the United States would become much more expensive and we wouldn't buy them.
Right.
So they'd like to keep it cheap, all right, so they can sell their goods in the United States. The problem is that you can't slow the economy down because it's locked in, all right? The Chinese government can't slow their economy down. 2 years ago, they were about 9.5% growth rate. And they thought that was too much. It was not good for China. It was not good for the world, all right? And the Chinese government started to put not big breaks, but they tried to break it, all right? It didn't work. It went from 9.5 to 10 to 11%. We're talking about, a billion people with 11%, gross national product growth each year is destroying us. And they have a lot of money. I mean real money in their banks, not borrowed money. I'm talking about hundreds of billions of American dollars are in their banks, and guess what? They're coming back and buying American bonds.
Yeah.
All right? They are a holder of a huge quantity of American bonds. All right? Way over $100 billion in American bonds, and it could be $200 billion by now. I don't know. So now they are our creditor. If we screw around with them in plain English, all right, and they decided to dump their bonds are already a weak dollar, what would happen? That's like a hammer they have over our heads. All right? Now, I know militarily we're strong, but this is not a military fight with them. This is a financial fight. All right? What are we going to do? What are we going to do if something erupts? Let's just say we have problems with Iran, which we are having. You got China backing them up because they're getting oil from Iran. You got Russia backing them up because they're selling, products to them. In fact, Putin last week said, that they didn't like our foreign policy with Iran. Brooks, I don't know if you remember this, all right, but somewhere I read that in their final days, all right, and it probably was in a book of Revelation, not that I'm very religious. I believe in the spirit and I believe in all of that, but I'm an engineer and I read things. I often wondered how, if Armageddon ever happened, according to to the scriptures, how would China and Russia and Persia team up against the United States, and that's the way it's going to happen. Now, I'm not saying it's going to happen that way, and I want to predict that, all right? But it's so unusual that this thing would happen in our time frame.
Well, I don't know about the world politics. We don't discuss them much here on this program. There are plenty of programs that do that. But I do see that when there is a technological solution, and I believe everything we do eventually affects the universe, talking about it here
on X Squared Radio, there are millions of listeners all around the world that listen to this program either live or as an archive. And this, by the way, will be placed in our free listening area, so you won't even have to pay to listen to this program. It's so important to get this information out there that we're going to leave it in our free listening area at X Squared Radio, and hopefully at BBS Radio, which is our network as well. We might be able, there's still time, if those people that are in control, and we're going to talk about that in a second, would take action soon enough. And, you know, we live in a nation where free markets control everything. We control literally the price of everything in our country, with the exception of maybe cigarettes and health care. But that's only because the government controls the taxing and the regulation of the insurance. But as far as products bought and sold over the counter, we set the price. So if we, as American people, decide that we want to be energy independent, all we really have to do is find a company that has the solution for that technology and support it. And that technology will come to fruition so fast in our country, like a space race, we will solve our own energy problems. Because we, as a people, are in control of that. Not governments, not military. We are in control of that. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. We need a program similar to the one that put us on the moon. In 1999, 2000, I wrote an editorial, which is not on my website, by the way. And in that editorial, the solution really is the technology marrying up with the American farmer. The American farmer is the wild card. They could get us out of this energy crunch in a heartbeat if they had the money to do it. They can grow the crops that we need, including algae and everything else that's required. And it is certainly, even according to the INEL reports, sufficient land to do that, and land that would not be agricultural. Brooks, pretty much, let's take a look. You know, we're in Washington, the state of Washington. There's a press release on our website that talks about it. All right. But what's important in this little town of Odessa, Washington, okay, is the fact that, you know, the local farmers got together with our company, all right, and decided to do one thing different, which was exactly what I outlined in 1999 and 2000. They decided to grow the crop, build their own crushing plant, build their own biodiesel plant, and make their own fuel locally. They just cut the world out of the entire market. Look at what a farmer does. He takes his crop, takes it to market, sells it, gets some money for it. And he goes right back to the feed store and buys feed from the local market with all the value added onto it to bring back to his house, and he goes and buys fuel. All right?
Right.
First thing is that if there's ever a fuel crunch, all right, if a farmer brings to our plant seed, I am not only the pumping well, all right, but I'm also the refinery. He gives me seed. I give him back fuel. His tractors will run no matter what happens in the rest of the world. That's number one. Number two is that...
These farmers have now put themselves in their own fuel loop. They fuel their own tractors with their own seed.
That's right. And number two is that if they actually go and sell their bushels and buy the feed from the local feed market, all the crushers, many, many years ago, Cargill and ADM and all of them, closed down all the small crushing plants. They put them in the Midwest and back east, all right? So, and they use a process called hexane, which is really a volatile solvent to extract all the oil. So what you get back is meal for your cattle, where they've drawn practically all of the nutrients out of it. And by the way, they leave some hexane back. You know, parts per million, but it's still a poison. So what you're giving back to your cattle, all right, is not the same feed that I would give them. The same feed we give back to the cattle has no hexane in it, and it has some of the natural oils and the enzymes and the proteins and all of that left. So the cattle gets better, all right, and they buy it from their own facility. They should be investing in their own facility, and then you know what happens? We've just cut everybody out of the loop.
Now, what about the price per gallon? Is the farmer going to have to pay $3.75 a gallon for the biodiesel to put in his tractors?
Okay, that's a good question, all right? Right now, all right, we are, in fact, the whole industry competes with rack price diesel. So we're the same price, you know? Even so, there's some niche markets. It's not like ethanol. Ethanol is mandated. No matter what the price of ethanol is, they got to buy it. Last summer, not this summer, but the summer before, spot price of ethanol went to $5 a gallon, all right? You had to buy it no matter what. Mostly, and I don't know any states except maybe Minnesota so far, where it's mandated that you have to put it in your tank. So if it's not mandated, and I'm not, by the way, I don't believe in mandates, but if it's not mandated, all right, then it's an open market. You're competing with rack price diesel, and that's what you got to sell it for.
And so biodiesel competes heads up with rack price diesel.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, you know, look what happens to a bushel that he sells. He sells it to somebody who buys it. And that person stores it, all right, and then sells it to someplace else where they have to transport it. They sell it to a crushing facility. The crusher, they crush it, all right, they package it, they transport it. It goes through a distributor and to the retail, and you buy it back if it's been marked up 7, 8, 9 times. Why would you want to pay all that value added? If you bring it to me and you own part of our plant, the value added goes in your pocket. Even if you paid $4 a gallon, I'm not saying you would, but if you paid $4 a gallon for biodiesel to put in your tractors, you would make it all back on the profits of the plant that you partly own. And one thing, this is the cheapest, absolutely the cheapest insurance you can buy that any disruption of the oil supply in the world will not affect you. In 1972, all right, I was in New York City, and I saw what happened. 16 days we had an oil embargo. 16 days, and they cut off about 15% of the supply to the U.S. They were fighting in the streets. At that time, I was building houses. I couldn't get my roofer to come and put the roof on the house before winter, my houses, unless I promised him no money would. He said, "I can't come. I don't care what you offer me. No overtime, no nothing. Unless you could promise me, guess what? 5 gallons of gasoline. Gasoline became more important than money in a lousy 16 days of 15% cutoff of the United States oil. What do you think would happen in a serious situation? There would be panic everywhere. And one other thing is that we make a lot of ethanol in this country. I mean, quite a bit. I mean, we really pushed that up quite a bit.
And what are they doing with it, though? I mean,
okay,
the ethanol broke.
Brooks, our transportation system doesn't run on ethanol. All the trucks on the road, all the railroads, everything run on diesel.
You want to go to the beach?
Good. You might be really hungry because there's nobody to bring you any food, but that's what's going to happen. You know, and you know, during the program, I saw you did a little piece on food, you know, long-term storage of food.
Right, right.
Yeah, now
one of our sponsors is NitroPack, and they do emergency food supply.
Listen, for years, I've been telling people to do a couple of things, very simple things, and it's insurance. It's the cheapest insurance you ever buy. Go out and buy, I say, at least, I really would like them to buy 3 or 4 months' worth, but people won't do that. At least buy 3 or 4 weeks' worth of food and put it in a box so you can grab it real quick. 2 or 3 boxes. And then the second piece, which nobody ever recommended before, you know, the old Mercedes vehicles like 1980s and early 1990s, usually those Mercedes, if you look on the internet, they're very cheap. They're like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. And they all have papers. You know all the work that's been done to them because they're Mercedes. They're not like American cars.
Yeah.
You know, people who buy Mercedes keep meticulous records. You can buy a Mercedes, and the old Mercedes have low compression engines, 14, 15 to 1, and big injectors on them. You know what that means? They run forever on anything. You could take Missoula corn oil out of your kitchen in a pinch and put in that car to run.
Really?
Absolutely. All right? And a lot of other stuff, even worse quality. It will run on almost anything. So you've paid $3,000 for an old Mercedes, and you put it in your garage. Now, the one thing about diesel, it's not explosive. It's not like gasoline. You can't carry gasoline in your trunk of your car or in your garage. But diesel, go buy a few, you know, two 5-gallon cans of diesel and put it in the trunk of that car. Now, let me tell you what you've just done. All right? Between the gas tank and the 10 gallons you have in the trunk, you now have a range pushing 900 miles. All right? And if anything happens, all right, you take the two boxes of water for 3 weeks and food and throw it in your back. Now, people say, well, why should I do that? I'm going to tell you why, all right? Remember Katrina, the catastrophe? Of course, we all remember that.
Sure.
But how many people remember that 2 or 3 weeks later, Houston, all right, was threatened with another Category 4 storm? And a million people tried to leave there. You know what happened? No food. They got stranded on the highways. They ran out of gasoline on the cars, and they were stranded. A million people on highways. All right?
Absolutely.
Because they didn't follow what I told them. How about the fires in California? You know, two people called me up in the last few days and said, Joe, I took your advice, and it worked perfectly. He said, when the fires came in, I got in my Mercedes, threw the water and food in, and I ran to Utah. Because you're 900 miles, you put yourself in Montana. You know, you're not part of the problem any longer. You're not out there competing with the food that's in a local area in some Astrodome someplace. You get the hell out of town, and you have a huge, and not only that, if you run out of fuel anywhere, you can go to a supermarket and throw Mazola corn oil, and you keep on going. Now, that's the cheapest insurance policy you will ever buy. Not only that, people say, well, you know, it's an old car, what happens if it breaks down? Let me tell you that, all right? I had a 84 Mercedes, and the rear end, which is very seldom ever goes out on a Mercedes, but the rear end went out. I figured this is a $5,000 deal. So I went to the Mercedes dealer. Mechanic says, listen, he says, these rear ends, you know, never go out. He says, the junkyards are full of them. He says, for $300, I'll go buy one for you and put it in. It cost me $300 to put a rear end in a 1984 Mercedes. Would you believe that? You know?
Wow.
And the diesel engine and those old diesel Mercedes will run 500,000 miles, get you over 30 miles per gallon. Maybe even more if you're a good driver.
Well,
what
I know,
can you ask for?
The last time I was in Europe, I rented a turbo Peugeot, and it got 44 miles to the gallon at 100 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah. They're absolutely, they don't advertise that. You know, in 1998, when they came out with the new Volkswagen, well, people don't even know that in 1998, they thought they were all gasoline. That's not true. They also came out in diesel. I had one, all right?
Yeah.
They didn't even put the word diesel on the car. But you want to know why? Because they're all sold. They're pre-sold. They can't make enough of them, and they can't import. You know, they only can import a certain amount to the United States. So in 1998, they made a diesel Volkswagen, you know, the first model out, and I had it, and it got like 48 miles to the gallon, you know. I drive a Passat now, by the way, which gets, if you're really a good driver, at 65 miles an hour, you're pushing 55 to 60 miles per gallon, and that's true, and it's got all the power in the world, all right, and it doesn't behave like a diesel. You can't even hear it. It sounds like a... Like, go drive one. Go to your Volkswagen. Not in California, they don't even sell them. You can't even get one, all right? But if you find one and take a test drive on it, remember, these engines normally last 300,000 to 500,000 miles, get 45, 50, 55 miles to the gallon. You got to buy one.
Well, that's enough to talk about for 2 hours. We got a little less than 1 hour left. We're going to take a quick break, about 4, maybe 5 minutes, and we'll be back with more of Joe LaStella and this great technology. And we're gonna go into the future with this and see what problems we can solve and how we can make life better for all of us. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio after this. Down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication.
This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer.
There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today.
If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. And we're going into the future right now. My guest is Joseph Listella. He is the president of Green Star Products, and they have some technology which is certainly has the potential to solve a lot of the problems that we have right now in our society. As far as energy goes, we want you to join our program. You can call us toll-free anywhere in the United States. The number is 877-270-8714.
Anywhere in Canada, toll free 888-228-4494. And anywhere on planet or off planet, the number is 530-413-4511. We might be having a little bit of technical difficulties. I don't know if somebody picked up the telephone and tried to dial out just now. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State up here in Big Sky Country. And we're talking with Joseph LaStella. Joseph, are you still there?
Right here.
Okay. I believe we're still live. We are talking about bringing biodiesel produced by the American farmer for the American farmer. Now, one of the things that that we want to make clear to the American farmer is, Joe, are you still there?
Right here.
Okay. I just I hear somebody picking up and laying down my phone line, so I want to make sure that we're still there.
Yeah.
The American farmer is really the backbone of our country. Our country was founded on farming. It survives on farming. We're still the largest producer and overproducer of food in the world. The last 4 or 5 years, what has happened is fuel. The requirements for fuel has competed with the kitchen table for the output of the American farmer. And economics being what they are, and farmers being not only hard workers, they're also businessmen. They see the profits in producing corn upon corn, and they're literally ruining their land trying to tap in to literally billions of dollars laying there in this high high-tech fuel. But they don't understand the industry, and in fact, I don't know if anybody in Washington really understands that mechanism. But there is hope, because now there is new technology that it appears Green Star Products has introduced that will allow us to practically use really non-usable land and non-usable water to produce feedstock for the biodiesel industry. Now, admittedly, this is brand new technology, but Joseph, how long would it take, if you had proper funding, how long would it take to bring biodiesel provided by feedstock made by algae, by your algae, to the fuel tank? How long are we talking?
Very short period of time. This, in 2008, we will build a 100-acre farm and then a 1,000-acre farm. But by any standards, that's really a small amount. When they did the research program over the 17-year period by the federal government, they envisioned, you know, massive fields of algae production. I'd like to read something, you know, another conclusion by the NREL study. It says, and I'd just like to read it, this is one of their many conclusions. In a world of ever more limited natural resources, algae technology offers the opportunity to utilize land and water resources that are today unsuited for any other use. Land use needs for microalgae complement rather than compete with other biomass-based fuel technologies. I mean, that says it all. You know, we certainly can bring it online very quickly. It's all based on financing. You know, there are some small problems left. When I say small problems, it means that we need to improve, not create. You know, if you have a problem, you have to create a new solution. That's one thing. But if you have
to
improve something,
caller line
harvesting,
four. Caller line four.
The harvesting, not the growth, not the algae, not the production, all right? We can make plenty of algae. But the harvesting and extracting of oil, even so we do it now on a regular basis, right around the corner there will be other methods which will do it better, quicker, and faster. Now, and by the way, we do have some of our own patent pending technologies in that area.
Well, before we get into that, one of my IMers, Cinefex One, has a question, and he's asking if you have ever used or heard of the feasibility of any Tesla technology that could be used to power or charge batteries without any external source. That's his question.
Okay. That is, listen, you're opening up a door there. Our company, Green Star Products, has had a reputation in the industry for a very long time. If you have a new technology, and this is a matter of fact, the last 12, 13, 14 years, if you have something, a new gadget, what are you going to do with it? You're going to patent it and try to sell it yourself? You're going to try to sell it to an automobile company? What are you going to do with it, all right? Are you going to try to, prove it yourself and take it to Southwest Research, where before you walk in the door, you better walk in with a check, as a retainer for $100,000? Well, there's another alternative. They can come to our company, all right, and they can show it to us. And they say, what do you think of this? We have under our roof, everything. We are a one-stop company. We have our own production facilities. We have 90,000 square feet of production facility in Idaho. We manufacture the entire biodiesel plant, that we build. We build it. We've designed it. We've patented it. We transport it to the field. We put it together, and we operate it. One stop. Not only that, all right, people know we also have our own dynos. All right? So if you have something, a new additive, a filter, whatever it is, you come in the front door and say, gee, maybe I have something, and if I like it, or one of our executives like it, we'll, at no cost, we'll try it. And if it works, we'll tell you it works, and we'll try maybe to make a deal with you. Let me tell you, 99% of everything we try does not work. Additives don't work, and this doesn't work, but once in a while, Brooks, somebody walks in the front door with something that's opened the door to something new, and then we look at it, and we make a deal for it, and then we improve it. That's what we do. That's the type of company we are. So we get a chance to see everything first. We have technology sitting on the shelf, all right, that's not ready to maybe to come to the public just because of one thing. We don't have enough funds to do all the research. I mean, once you have an invention, to take it from the invention stage to the profitable stage is a huge step. Most of the inventions in Washington have never been even built or sold publicly. I mean, there's fantastic inventions that were done at the turn of the century. Every time we look at something, you need to go back and find out what's been done. We've had some pretty sharp people in the United States over 100 years that have thought of a lot of simple things that do work. So the answer to your question is, yes, we take a look at everything, and I have not seen anything that would resemble perpetual motion. Now, I want to make that very clear. That doesn't mean that things cannot run with outside power. That means you're doing something internally to get the power. There's no such thing as perpetual motion. But you could break down, molecules on some of the level that we don't know about and extract energy. Obviously, Einstein knew that, talking about Einstein for a minute, Brooks, I got to tell you a funny story. Einstein was asked a question. He says, after he discovered this E equals MC squared, they said to Einstein, what's your next discovery?
Yeah.
And he answered, he says, besides what I've already discovered, the next thing is understanding compound interest. Compound interest, all right? What does that mean? 10% interest in 7.5 years doubles.
Right.
However, let's put it in the. Can you hold on 1 second? Brooks, just a second.
Yeah, I'm holding.
Brooks, but when you apply that same statement to algae, all right, I think early in the program we talked about it, all right? One single cell of algae becomes a million in 15 days, a trillion in the next 15 days, and 15 days after that, 45 days down the road, there's so many zeros on it, I don't know what the number is. It's the number that comes after quadrillion, all right? That means that we're producing oil at a fantastic rate that took Mother Nature millions of years to do. So that's what Einstein was talking about. It's this compounded rate that keeps doubling and doubling and doubling, and the only thing is the time interval in between that makes a difference.
Yeah. So we have the capability of taking this 100-million-year-old work that Mother Nature has done for us and capitalizing on it. We have the ability to take what she has done and put it in our gas tanks and burn it. By the way, I think it is a lot lower polluting than normal diesel fuel. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. If you make biodiesel out of algae oil, the particulates are down 80 to 90%. CO is down. Hydrocarbons are down. It's really a clean-burning fuel.
And
no smoke out of the exhaust and things like that.
One of the requirements of the 2007 and newer diesel engines on which the semis operate is that they have to use low sulfur diesel. They won't even run on the regular diesel at the pump. They require special diesel. Can they run on biodiesel?
Absolutely. You know, when they took the sulfur out of diesel, sulfur was the natural lubricant in diesel. And Bosch, which makes 85% of all the injectors throughout the world, warned all the manufacturers that the injectors would prematurely fail, and the OEM manufacturers of engines said the same thing would happen to engines. They lost their lubricity. However, all right, the study has also shown that by adding just 2% of biodiesel will not only put back what they lost out of the sulfur, but was a better lubricant than the original sulfur they took out. That's why, you know, Chrysler in their Jeep Liberty, which is a diesel, and their trucks comes off the factory line with 5% biodiesel in them.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's why they're very friendly to us right now, and that's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons, because by putting biodiesel in their fuel, they get lubrication back. But they also get some other things, too. Biodiesel naturally has 10% oxygen in it, and diesel has no oxygen, so it's oxygenated. It also has zero aromatics. In California, there's a limitation for diesel of 10% on aromatics, and I'm telling you, Brooks, not one refinery meets that any day of the week. We've tested all of them. But they make some other, you know, other concessions, and they get away with it. They put a little more of this, and they get away with it. However, biodiesel has zero aromatics, so we approved aromatics. And the last but not least, when you go to the pump and buy gasoline, don't you pay an awful lot more for octane? I mean, if you go from 89 to 91, don't you pay like 20 cents more a gallon?
Yeah, you sure do. And sometimes, like my truck has high compression in it, it won't run on regular without pinging really bad.
Oh, yeah,
I need to run premium, and it's expensive to drive.
That's right. But the equivalent to that in diesel engines is called cetane, all right? And normal diesel has a cetane number 45, 47, and biodiesel has a cetane of 50 to 55 or even 60. So we're giving cetane away for nothing.
Yeah.
There's no premium for all these things, the lubrication, the cetane, and zero aromatics, and we still have to compete with diesel on a one-to-one basis when we're a better fuel and we lower emissions. Now, the last thing, and I wish every congressman could hear this, all right?
We'll make sure that they do.
Because it's so important. Every time I tell a senator this, they're astonished by it. We don't care what we pay for biodiesel because if you, for example, if you had a choice, if you were Mother Earth, right, and you're looking at, just look at 1 gallon of biodiesel, and you had the choice to burn that 1 gallon in one vehicle or take that 1 gallon and spread it out over 20 vehicles in what's called like a B5, 5% biodiesel, all right? That choice would obviously put 5% in 20 vehicles because the first piece of diesel, of biodiesel you put in an engine, you get a whole lot more emissions reduction than the last 5%, which means to Mother Earth that 1 gallon in 20 vehicles produces less collective emissions than putting it in one vehicle.
Well,
now, that's very important. The other thing is from a financial point of view. All right? If you pay even $4 or $5 for biodiesel and you put it in a B5, you know, it only raises the final B5 cost a few pennies, maybe the most a nickel, all right? Or maybe even less, you know, at a B2 it raises it 1 or 2 cents. You will never see that at the pump, all right? A truck driver will go up there with especially today, with numbers jumping up and down, 10, 15 cents a day. You think they ever see an extra nickel in there? So what are they talking about? You know, the whole point is that nobody cares, nobody can see it, all right? Everything is so expensive anyhow that the 5 cents extra per gallon and you get so much more benefit. You know, it takes us off foreign oil, it reflects in our balance of payment deficit, it cleans up the air. They don't understand financing. They're lawyers, they're not engineers, they're not accountants, and you have to educate them. This is an educational process.
Oh, man. Well, Joe, I think we have another caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from, and your first name, please?
Well, I'm sorry. My name is Mahmoud. I'm calling again. I just want to make a couple of comments, if you don't mind.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, regarding Einstein, you were talking about Einstein. Let me paraphrase what he said. He said, you cannot solve present and future problems with old technologies. Also, according to History Channel, I was watching a program a couple of days ago. There are 57 million acres of agricultural land in the United States. And you could imagine how many quadrillions of gallons of water is needed. As a result, 35 states in the United States will be depleted or going into a drought, you know, depleted out of water going into a drought. That's all the comments I want to make, you know.
Yeah, I understand.
So we need to take that into consideration, you know, that we're not depleting oil, we're also depleting water to grow these crops, you know.
Yeah, well, I agree. Usually we have rain fall out of the sky, but there has been a drought, and we are pumping water from deep beneath the earth to irrigate. Even here where I'm broadcasting from in eastern Washington State, about a third of the property is irrigated from wells as deep as 2,500 feet. So you're exactly right. That is what they're doing.
57 million acres, when Joe was referring to if we only use 3% of the land in the United States to use for algae, it will satisfy all our needs for oil and will be totally independent of oil from foreign countries. Only 3%, not 57 million acres.
Well, that's really powerful news, don't you think, that we could solve the oil problem with only 3%? And we're not talking about prime agricultural property. We're talking about just flat land that no one's using for anything.
Yeah. That's all the comments I need to make. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Thanks.
So, Joe, one of the things that we use oil for, and I know that it comes from foreign countries, and by the way, one of the reagents that's currently used in the biodiesel industry is methanol. And is that produced here in the United States?
Brooks, boy, you hit that one right on the head. You know, all the biodiesel in the United States, 99% of it is produced with methanol, and methanol is no longer manufactured in the United States. It's produced from natural gas, and when the natural gas prices went up, it stopped being manufactured, and it's manufactured all outside the United States. So we're not energy independent. We rely on other countries to bring methanol in, most of them from Central and South America. Also, methanol is derived from natural gas, which means that makes the biofuel not even totally renewable. However, all right, we can use ethanol in place of that, which would make us totally energy independent and totally renewable.
Okay, now once the ethanol is used in the biodiesel process, then that same biodiesel can be, you know, shipped to other places. You don't have the same distribution trouble that you do with, say, E85.
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly right. By using ethanol to make biodiesel, and biodiesel requires, you know, 10%, you know, it doesn't affect that. It's a chemical process, and you don't have to worry about the ethanol and biodiesel affecting, you know, and grabbing water.
So what we should really be lobbying Congress for right now is a joint venture between the already bought and paid for ethanol plants and Joe's algae-driven biodiesel plants so that we can keep the ethanol production that we have, the ethanol plants that we have, and have a completely renewable biodiesel program.
Well, Brooks, that's absolutely correct. And if you go back a couple of years in our press releases, we talked about the future, what is called the biorefinery, which brings everything under one roof. In reality, in a perfect world, and by the way, this, I'm not talking about perfect world 50 years from now. I'm talking about perfect world 6 months from now. All of this already exists. You could build an ethanol plant alongside a biodiesel plant, all right? And the ethanol plant can be fed not by corn, all right?
Right.
Ethanol can be made from the waste products, including the following: the corn cob, rice stalks, municipal waste. All of those things have cellulosic, capabilities to make ethanol out of. And people say it's 5 years away. Not true. All right. In our consortium, all right, we have the technology right now to do that. So look at what happens. On one side, you know, the cellulosic plant makes ethanol with waste products from, you know, it could be sugar cane, orange peels, municipal waste, wood chips, all of those products. And because it is a different type of process, unlike corn, all right, it produces two different carbon chains, both C5 and a C6. The C6 becomes ethanol. C5 becomes a variety of products throughout the world. And one of those products, believe it or not, is a thing called furfural, F-U-R-F-U-R-A-L. And that is a basic chemical for almost 10,000 products, most of them manufactured in the United States and other countries too. 10,000 products, and it all comes from China today. That is the byproduct of cellulosic ethanol. It's a product that's used in 10,000 other products and throws off so much, value, okay, because it's sold by the pound, that the ethanol product could be sold for a lot less than we think ethanol should be selling for today.
So where does our supply of furfural come from now?
It almost comes entirely from China.
Now,
the good part of it is that when furfural used to sell for about 80 cents a pound, China came into the market and flooded the market and reduced to 25 cents a pound, but they were also polluting the atmosphere pretty well. And the Chinese government came down on all these small mom-and-pop operations and stopped them. So it's on its way back up again. I don't know what it is right now, but the last I heard it was about 50 cents a pound, all right? And that's the byproduct. And in a cellulosic ethanol plant, it can produce enough money to pay for everything. So the future is that waste products come in one side, just waste products. Energy comes out the other side. And when I mean energy, I mean, ethanol comes out, biodiesel comes out, chemicals come out, furfural comes out, high-protein food comes out, fertilizers come out. Now, that's not something that somebody dreamed up in some university. These technologies are here today. Don't believe what they're saying 5-10 years away. They're here.
So what would it take to put these things on a space race type scale? Because believe me, Earth explorers, you know as well as I do that this nation can put resources together like no nation in history. But what we need is for the general public to be aware that we are on the edge of a crisis. And I don't mean a crisis like one that is going to end life as we know it on this planet. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I am saying that there's a crisis that could end life as we know it on this planet.
Oh.
We don't have to worry about developing the technology to get off this world. All we really have to do is develop the technology to learn how to live with this world. And it's here, right now, on this program, tonight.
Brooks, in 1957, I was 17 years old, okay? And I wanted to become an astronaut, and, of course, Sputnik was put up first, you know, spacecraft from Russia, and that launched the U.S. into the space race. What it took was the people in the United States and the government had to be frightened that we were losing something, something very valuable, and then we decided to get up to space and put a man on the moon, and we did it, all right, because we came to bear with all of our technology to do exactly one thing, all right? For every piece of the space race, all right, in those eras, for everything that had to be created, if they needed one PhD, they put 10 on it because they had to have it done until something drastic happens, and that something drastic is about to happen. Every morning when I wake up, and I'm not kidding, it could happen in a heartbeat. The U.S. public and the Congress will jump on this with all the money and resources you can imagine, and hopefully, just hopefully, we have enough time. You know, we talked about energy. We talked about peak oil. We didn't talk a lot about global warming. And global warming is not 50 years away or 20 years away. It could happen tomorrow morning, very, very seriously. And I hope we have, you know, the next 20, 25 minutes to talk about that.
What's the threshold we're talking about here, Joe? I mean, I know we've talked about before on this program, deep beneath the ocean where it's cold and there's lots of pressure, there's another ocean. And that ocean is made of methane. And it needs a cold ocean to keep that methane in liquid form at the bottom of the sea. If that ocean gets a little bit warmer, that methane's going to start going gaseous, and it's going to start bubbling up out of the ocean,
Brooke.
And then everything changes.
Wait, that's so funny because it's so true and it's so deadly, all right? That methane gas down there is, you know, is compressed in liquid form, and it's in a delicate balance. There's eons of methane gas, and if we disturb that balance in the ocean and we release it, we don't have to worry about a whole lot anymore because we would be in dire straits that you wouldn't believe. Methane gas, as a global warming gas, is 20 times more potent than CO2. It doesn't last as long as in the atmosphere. It only lasts 25 years, enough to wipe us out. Well,
yeah.
CO2 lasts 100 years. But methane gas is disastrous. It's also stored in the frozen tundra of the north. You know, the permafrost ground,
right,
that's now thawing out. You know, I don't know if you saw those on the Discovery Channel. They had these truckers that go across and deliver products in across the frozen ground to the north. Well, at one time they had 175 days of frozen ground. They're down to 75 days. Well, that frozen ground also contains large quantities of methane gas. And that could happen to us in a really very short period of time.
Well, what can we do to reverse this? I mean, we're going to have to quit dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We have heard many times on many popular radio programs and television programs that the operation of man on this world really has no significant effect, that you know, a few natural disasters and all of this would be cleaned up and forgotten about. But the fact is that we do steadily push CO2 into the atmosphere, and algae's not able to keep up with it because, as you know, algae, once it gets about 3 or 4 inches deep in the water, it doesn't grow because the wavelength of light it takes for algae to grow gets filtered out. So algae grows near the surface. And unfortunately, the surface is where most of the pollution is as well. So this delicate balance is being affected by us. And if it gets to a certain point, we're going to have a cataclysmic effect on our own planet.
Brooks, you couldn't be more correct. Early in this program, I read, you know, a summation of a report from on NREL, and I'm going to repeat it because it's so important. The conclusion was human beings are carrying out a large-scale geophysical experiment of a kind that could not have happened in the past nor will happen in the future. Within a few centuries, we are returning to the atmosphere and the oceans the concentrated organic carbon stored sedimentary rocks over 100 million years. That says it all. And we don't know the results of it. Global warming is slowly just encompassing us in ways we could never dream before. You know what's funny? I got off the plane 3 hours ago, and the farmers drove me in St. Louis here, and we were talking about just that. And he says, you know something, Joe? He says, nobody ever saw an armadillo in Missouri, and now we see armadillos everywhere. They're coming north, all right? And what I said is that that's what you see. Everything else is coming north with it. All the diseases, all the plants, all the insects, everything is coming into an environment that's absolutely new to them, and they will destroy your environment. For example, in California, all right, they've had a disease called Pierce's disease for 100 years. It came and it went, and then they got the glassy-winged sharpshooter grasshopper came in, which is very difficult to deal with, and now it takes this bacteria and it's going from grapevine to grapevine, and eventually can wipe out a large percentage of the grapevines in California. We did it, all right? It got warm, the grasshopper came north. That's the only things that we see. Other things, viruses and bacteria are coming north at an accelerated rate, and we don't know how it's going to affect the environment around us.
If we can't stop the grasshopper, how are we going to save these wine vineyards? How are we going to save the vineries, the wineries in California? Sorry,
well,
I got my letters all mixed up.
I brought that up because one of our associate companies, you know, the biotech research, has through their research in their facility in Mexico with their PhDs, have come up with an inoculation, all right, to do just exactly that. It's not available yet, but it will be available very, very soon. As simple as inoculating a grapevine like you would inoculate, you know, in the Army when they punch, you know, an electric injection into your arm, you know. And what they developed is a bacteria that feeds on that bacteria only. And what happens eventually is that once it kills the bacteria, it loses its food source, so both die. Absolutely will not go into the grapevine. It will not get into the food system, and, you know, it will not affect the taste of grapes. Right now what they're doing, which is totally ineffective, is they're putting antibiotics into these grapevines, which does get into the grape, does get into the wine, and does get into the wine you drink. And now, you know what happens with antibiotics, you know, bacteria becomes
resistant
to them, and then they become super bacteria, just like things are happening around right now, like, you know, what's happening in the hospitals.
Oh, we just shut down a school system in eastern Kentucky, and there's another one in New York shutting down because children in those schools are dying because of antibiotic-resistant Staphylococcus bacteria. So it's coming, Joe,
yeah,
and we're creating it ourselves.
Yeah, and the federal government knows that. I think there's a low-lying fear of it. And, you know, they're building, I wouldn't say secret, but semi-secret laboratories everywhere with some of the top scientists in the world, you know, to try to find cures for this or to try to stop a sustainable, you know, epidemic. And I'm not just talking about, you know, from hearsay. I know exactly where they are and what they're doing. So they're making an effort because they fear that an outbreak of this type would be, I mean, they'll quarantine a whole city if they have to. Quarantines of entire cities and states are in our future. Every single state and every city has a program to quarantine everything, you know, and you won't get out. You'll just stay there until whatever happens.
Well, I know I was in an earthquake once back in 1969, and we lived in a valley in Southern California. And in about 24 hours, we decided the water wasn't going to come back on, and there were some gas leaks in the area, and the National Guard was trucking ice in and things like that. We decided that we would go over and spend time with family in Santa Monica. So we got in our car, and we drove down Los Angeles Avenue, and we hit the highway and started going over. And guess what we hit?
we hit a roadblock.
Wow.
And they said, we're sorry, but you cannot leave the valley. And we said, but we have no water. We have no electricity, and there's natural gas leaking up out of the streets, and, you know, it could take weeks to clean this up and get power back on, and, you know, we want to go spend time with family over there. And they said, you cannot migrate, because if everyone in this valley left, you would go out and overload other areas that also got hit by the earthquake. So we experienced that very same quarantine. The grocery stores were empty. The gas stations were empty. And if we didn't have the National Guard bringing us food and water in, we would have all died in that valley.
Oh, yeah. Listen, you know, to show you how things happen, just try to come home New Year's Eve from Las Vegas the next day, New Year's Day, right? And anything goes wrong on that highway. I was involved in that one time. Well, you have all those cars coming back from New Year's Eve, all right? You have an accident on the parkway, and all of a sudden, everybody's sitting there, you know, running their engines, getting hungry, all right? Within hours, all the gas stations along the were out of gas. Nobody had gas. People were running out of gas. No more food. They bought every piece of food that you could eat. No more water, and everybody was still stuck out there. That's what I'm talking about. You know, we talked about early in this program, you know, a few bucks, you know, a diesel Mercedes, 3 weeks worth of food and water is your safe haven, no matter what, you know. And I'm not just saying that. I'm not a doomsdayist, all right? It would have helped out 1,000% if those people in Houston had it when they were running away from the hurricane, a million people on the highways, and two people who took my advice, all right, got out of this area with fire just this last week, all right, and got and people are saying, well, they're running away. No, they're not. They're not becoming part of the problem. All right. Whatever resources are left are left for the other people who have not prepared. So they're doing you a favor by doing that.
Let's shift it just a little bit. We've got about 15 minutes left in the program. I'm excited about another product that you were instrumental, in fact, are still instrumental in producing. One of the things that we rely on in oil is lubrication. We change our oil every 3,000 or every 5,000 miles in our vehicles now. And there are various additives that you aftermarket additives that you can add to your oil to make it a little more slippery and prevent wear in your engine. And some of them, you know, you've heard of Slick 50, you've heard of DuraLube and these other products out there. Excellent marketing campaigns. I've used some of their products. But then I tried a very remarkable product called TVT 24/7. Now, I'm not here to do an infomercial on it, but, Joe, this stuff's remarkable. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with it and what it does?
Brooks, you know, our company for a long time was an R&D company, you know, going back into late 90s, you know, and we weren't exactly had the greatest marketing team. You know, we're not in the marketing business. We're engineers. We build things. You know, we're very good at that, but we're not great at marketing. And we developed this product. It's a lubrication product. And eventually what we did is we formed a relationship with a company called NRG Resources, located in Newport Beach. And we manufacture it for them. They bottle it, market it, sell it all over the world. And it truly is, not because of my product, it truly is a remarkable product. Everyone that has tried it, and I'm not talking about every person, I'm talking about every company. And I'm not allowed to say what those companies are, but obviously several of them, some of the largest automobile companies in the world, have tried it, all right? And we're going through their certification process, all right? So far, absolutely clean, perfect, wonderful. Now, that's the big end of it. The small end of it, you know, we're starting to see it, you know, being sold in Flying J and things like that. However, what is public information? Don't forget, GSPI is a public corporation. In fact, those are the call letters. You know, Green Star Products, GSPI, OTC. And we're grossly undervalued. But please, that's not a, you know, a promotional thing. You know, I don't want anybody to buy any public stock in any alternate fuel company unless you understand what they're doing. because people have lost fortunes on that. Believe me, you know, so many biofuel companies, people have invested in them. They never had a chance of making any money. They lost 99% of their money within 1 year. So unless you're smart enough to understand what the company is doing, where they fit in the industry, don't buy any stock. Just stay away from it, because too many people are losing too much money. Do your homework. However, let's get back to TBT product. Last year and this year, one of our sponsored vehicles won different categories in the Baja 1000. We won the same category 2 years in a row. Many of the racing vehicles use TBT products. But the most astonishing one was the Russian Railroad. This is public information. You know, if you look at our website going back 2 years ago, I have all the information there, all right? The Russian Railroad is an astonishing, corporate company, all right? It's, believe it or not, the railroad covers 11 time zones. 11 time zones.
Wow.
I mean, when I first found that out, I was absolutely astonished by it. They employ 1.2 million people, and they're the largest diesel users in the world.
My goodness.
And they have research facilities that are comparable to anything else in the world. So when you make a mistake there, you're making a mistake of the backbone of the country. So when we gave it to them, through NRG Resources has extensive connections in Russia and Kazakhstan. They did, and I spoke to the Russian engineer when he came back. He says, we tested your product, and when we first tested it, we didn't believe it. We thought we made a mistake. So before we took it any further, we initiated a program, and believe me, they did testing on this product that I never did, all right? They took every group of metals that meet, in their entire system, whether it be an alloy with cast iron or steel, whatever it is, and they went through the whole gamut. Because their first test, which may or may not be up on my website, if you look for it, it might be there.
And
but
that's
what
green,
happened.
That's greenstarusa.com, if you're
right,
listening live.
greenstarusa.com, and by the way, the stock sells pretty cheap, about 3.5 cents a share, which is, ridiculous, but we're OTC. And anyway, if you look at it, you will see that the Russian Railroad, there's a graph there, and on the x-axis is time, simple as time, hours, and the y-axis is temperature, very simple, temperature time. So they put it under a load condition, and their oil, which they used through their entire system, failed in, I don't remember exactly, but it was like 100 minutes or something like that. All right, and it failed. And it failed in temperature because it went all the way up to 87°C, all right?
Uh-huh.
So then they used the same oil, and they put one sample was 3% of our just 3% of our product with their oil, and the other one was 5% of their product and their oil, and they could not believe that a small amount like that never failed, went straight out, never increased in temperature. It was almost impossible. They couldn't believe it, and that's why they embarked on this program. Now, they're still testing it because you realize in Russia, if you make a mistake, they'd love to kill you, especially in the Russian Railroad.
Yeah.
But we've passed every test. I don't care what tests all the automobile companies have, foaming tests and biodegradability and corrosion tests. We've passed everything 100%. And very soon, I think we're going to make, a tremendous inroads into many, many industries. This is the next century, I think, lubricant, all right? It's earth-friendly. We make more than one product. We also make, cutting oils, all right, for the machine industry, and that's a really big industry. The CNC industry machines, computer-operated, where they use water-soluble cutting oils. We have the best water-soluble cutting oil anywhere, totally biodegradable.
Wow.
Anybody who's worked in a machine shop? Brooks, I think you work. You're familiar with machine shops.
Yeah, well, we used to make helical gears, bevel gears for the axle industry, for the Cadillac and for the new Solstice that's out and other vehicles. And I can tell you, we go through a lot of cutting tools on those rotary CNCs, not just taps, but also the blades that cut the spiral bevel gears. We go through a lot of them. And a good cutting solution
is priceless, and we spend a lot of money filtering it and cooling it and recycling it. You know, it's very, very expensive. It's a big part of the machining industry.
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. And the increase in tool, decrease in tool wear, all right? In other words, the tools lasted, you know, the number is so high I'm embarrassed to tell you, but it's at least five times longer. Not five, 500% longer, and a lot longer than that. So the tools were not wearing out. The friction is not there. It's gone, okay? And the water, this is water-soluble cutting oil. Normally they change them every 5 to 6 weeks because bacteria grows. It smells bad. The men, you know, that work on the machines, you have to be very careful you don't get cuts because the water will affect your cuts. That's all gone away, all right? No bacteria grows. The smell is great. Nobody has to worry about cuts on their hands anymore. And 1 minute after you put it in, you can hear the difference, all right? You get a better quality cut. Your tool doesn't wear out. And by the way, if anybody's taking like things like a trace metal analysis of the oil, you'll see, especially like in engines or gearboxes, you will see the trace metals, which are an indication of wear, just go down 90%. That's an engineering fact, all right, and it tells you how much you're wearing down the machine. There's no getting around that. So it is a great, great product, all right. It's sold by NRG, and I think it's going to be a huge winner in the near future.
Well, there you go. I know we've used high-speed compressors, 5,500 CFM compressors, and we do oil analysis on a regular basis because we want to know if the bearings and gears of that machine are wearing out before it becomes a problem. That way we can treat the oil or we can overhaul the machine on our schedule instead of when it flies to pieces and then it costs $500,000 to fix. But, you know, tribology, which is the study of lubrication, is a very competitive business, and it's usually won, in fact, it's all the time won, by the company that can do the best marketing, not by necessarily the best product on the market. For my money, and I've been doing manufacturing for over 30 years, that TVT 24/7 is the best stuff I've ever seen, and the technology behind it, I don't understand. I just know that it works. Well, we have about 5 minutes left, Joseph. Is there anything that a plea that you would like to make to us, to a call to action, as it were? What can we do to help turn this global warming?
Well, I think in the future, and I mean we're next 2 or 3 months, we might ask everyone listening to the station to write letters to their congressmen on several subjects and to have all their friends and buddies. It really does work. And my final story is early in the 1900s. You know, we came up with an idea. On my desk, all right, we wrote the law, all right? We thought of the law about giving access to diamond lanes in California to electric vehicles. Don't forget, we're in electric vehicle business, you know? And we did a study. And what happened was the study showed that executives don't want to run. They want access to the diamond lanes, but they don't want to be in, you know, carpools. So they will pay any amount of money for an electric car, any amount, because that's one, maybe it could be an hour a day more in their work cycle. And that's worth a lot of money to them, so they don't care about the car. So with this, all right, we drifted the literature on it, and we found an assembly person to take it into the state of California, and we actually got the assembly to accept that there was going to be a vote on it.
Uh-huh.
So we did that. Diamond lanes for electric vehicles only, and we found out that we had some connections up in Sacramento that wasn't going to carry. We were going to lose by 46-54. All right, that was kind of sad.
Yeah,
but we didn't give up. That's why I'm telling you a story for a reason, Brooks, all right? We have 10,000 stockholders in my company, and a lot of them are very aggressive environmentalists and have a lot of money, all right? We called everybody that we knew that would call somebody else, like a chain reaction. They got thousands of calls in Sacramento, all right? about this bill, and it passed the assembly. It was like, you know, the Truman Dewey deal. You know, we were going to lose, and we turned it around. We won 54-46.
Wow.
All right? That's the power of phone calls if everybody will pull together. Now, it didn't pass because the governor at that time had aspirations to run for president of the United States, and he didn't want to put Detroit's nose out of place, so he vetoed it, and we learned that he was going to veto it only 3 hours before he vetoed it, and it was not enough time to change his mind. So we had to wait 4 more years, all right, and we linked up with the gas companies, all right, to get natural gas vehicles and the diamond lanes, and that's what's happened today, all right? Now, even hybrids have access to it, you know, in some states, and it's spread across the United States, but the whole idea was invented on my desk, and now we're trying to push through a bill to get biofuel cars into the diamond lanes, so we have more biofuel cars out there. Anyway, the point here is that it does make a difference if we all pull together, so please, you know, if we ask you to do something, to write and tell your friends to do something, if you really believe in it, please do it. We can make a difference.
All right. That's what we needed. And I also want to let people know that if you go to the online store at X Squared Radio, TVT 24/7 is for sale there, and it would make a fantastic Christmas gift for somebody. Stop their engine from wearing, stop their manual transmission from wearing, your differential from wearing out. Make that thing last forever. We can't afford to keep buying new cars, you know. Pretty soon we're going to have FHA start underwriting the darn things because they're getting as expensive as houses. So if you want to keep it from wearing out, go to the online store at X Squared Radio. Pick yourself up some of that TVT 24/7. Joseph, it's been an absolute pleasure. I know I've taken 3 hours out of your extremely busy life. I know why you're there in St. Louis to talk to the managers and owners of a biofuel plant there to try to help them turn that one around. And I can't wait to see you again.
It's all about algae in Missouri. More than likely, the first algae that will come out in production will be here, right here outside of St. Louis.
That is amazing. Amazing news. Thank you so much for being on the program tonight.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
All right, my friends, that is another fast 3 hours of X Squared Radio. Joseph Listella is definitely a remarkable man, has had an effect for many, many decades in this country, and he's not through yet. A very young man, even at his age. And we'll see you next Sunday right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.